Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We have today an informational meeting, and we're gonna start off by an analysis of the revenue measures that are most likely headed to the ballot in January. And leading up that discussion, or leading off that discussion, will be our very own Dr. Werner and Chris are going to come up here and make our presentation. And we have copies back there for anybody who doesn't have them already.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Werner, let's say revenue officer. We literally finished this paper about 7 a.m. this morning, so we may have to check for typos. But a lot of the information, this is referred to referendum 301 and 302, the revenue measures, of course, which will be given ballot titles. They go on the ballot. What we've typically done in the past is produced a research report on whether they're citizen initiatives or measures that are referred by the legislature, like Measure 28, or measures that are referred through a citizens' referendum, like Measure 30. We've typically tried to lay out all the information that the legislature looked at in making its decisions and then try to cover as much of the things that we hear talked about or questions we're asked or that we know were components in the decisions made by the members and by the committee. So that's what our goal here is, to give you one spot where you've got kind of as comprehensive as we can be. And even having said that, we can think of a number of things that we could have put in here too that we didn't. So another thing we do plan to do in the next couple of weeks is to produce a frequently asked questions document as well, because we're getting a lot of questions. I'm sure you are too. And if there are things that you're getting frequent questions on, you think should be kind of widely available, just let us know, and we can include that in that document. What we'd like to do is walk through the report itself, really focusing on the tables, and then kind of talking about some of the issues that we think are a little bit tricky to explain. The first part of the report is the summary, and it goes through the different elements of it. The first major piece there is on page 4, which is the I referred to as the budget context. And we thought that was important to lay out because it really was the context in which the decision was made for the revenue measures. And you can see there on page 5, we have table 1 that lays out for kind of the fiscal landscape in which you are making those decisions in. We've gone back and recalculated what the budget gap was working with Legislative Fiscal Office, and it was a little over $4 billion based on the May forecast and the essential budget level. And the dollars that were used from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the $978 million were the dollars that were actually used to backfill general fund. There were some other dollars that were included in the budget, but not directly to backfill general fund. The state reserves, there is the rainy day fund that you've talked about, $225 million of that. And then, of course, the key issue is the additional revenue, which is $801 million. That's from all measures that affected the general fund, affected general fund revenue. The measures themselves combined for $733 million, or the vast bulk of that, $801 million. So the revenue measures themselves were about 20% of that budget balancing package, and about 50% were reductions from the current service level. And of course, remember that the current service level, particularly in human services, is rising significantly because of the stress the economy's under, the rising unemployment rate that you're aware of. So that was kind of the setting. And then from there, I'll have Chris go into the next section, just just going through those tables, describing the measures themselves in detail, and then going through the distribution effects in what we would call a static analysis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So as Paul indicated, I think everybody is familiar with the provisions here, so I'll walk through these relatively quickly. But just kind of highlighting the tables as we go through, just to walk through the report a little bit. On page 6, we have the revenue impacts for House Bill 2649 or Referendum 301. And there we have the three policies, the unemployment exclusion for tax year 2009 only. That would be an exclusion of up to $2,400 of unemployment compensation that would be excluded from the tax. And this was part of a policy adopted at the federal level with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. This would essentially tie to that provision. Then the two pieces that raise the revenue are the federal subtraction phase-out and the new marginal tax rates. And combined, the revenue impact for 09-11 is $472 million. And then 11-13 and 13-15, it's about $380 million each as the marginal rates drop from the 10.8 and 11% down to 9.9%. Moving over to Table 3 is a schedule for tax year 2009, the phase-out of how that federal tax subtraction would work. Under current law, the maximum federal tax subtraction for 2009 is $5,850, and that amount gets reduced in 20% increments depending on the level of AGI. So, for example, a single filer with AGI between $125,000 and $130,000 would be allowed a subtraction of 4,680, or 80% of the maximum. And then for the joint filers subject to that, they would have an AGI between 250 and 260,000. And then that works. The phase-out increases as income increases. So then for single filers over 145,000, joint filers over 290,000, the subtraction would be disallowed. Table 4 highlights how the rates are proposed to change in the bill. And in that first column there, the taxable income, those are the levels for 2009. And in the next column, the pre-HB 2649, that reflects the current 5, 7, and 9 rate structure. So we see the 9% rate kicking in at $15,200 and applies to all income above that. Under 2649, for tax years 09-11, there would be a 10.8% rate kicking in from $250,000 to $500,000 of taxable income. And then the 11% rate at $500,000. And these are for joint filers. Single filers, the taxable income levels would be half. And then we see the 10.8 and 11% are the temporary provisions. Beginning in tax year 2012, it moves to the permanent tax increase, which is the 9.9% rate applied to taxable income above $250,000. Table 5 provides some context for the history of the top marginal rates and the brackets at which they applied since the inception of the personal income tax, which began in 1930. And historically there, I just showed the top marginal rate, the number of brackets, and then where that top bracket kicked in. So, for example, in the first 3 years, 30 to 32, the top rate was 5% and applied to all taxable income above $8,000. One thing to point out is that from 1955 through 1986, the tax rates were higher than the current 9% and reached the highest level in 1955 and 56 at 11.6% at those income levels. So that's just a little bit of background in terms of the context. Moving on to page 8, table 6, it is actually a graph that compares AGI to taxable income. Now, in terms of the tax increase pieces of this, taxpayers will fit into one of three categories. Either they won't be affected by either tax increase, and that's about 97.5% of the filers in 2009, or they'll be affected just by the phase-out of the federal tax subtraction, or they'll be affected by both of them. And that's because the phase-out of the federal tax subtraction is based on AGI, and the tax rates are applied to taxable income, and taxable income tends to be less than AGI. And so with this table 6 shows is depending on the income level, and I'm noticing those didn't print out very well. They range from 0 to 500,000, 0 on the left to 500,000 on the right. We can see taxable income as a percentage of AGI increases from around 70% up to upwards of 90%. The overall average is 75%. So the one number in terms of taxable income as a share of AGI is 75%, but it does increase with income. Okay, so those are the key pieces to 2649. Moving on to House Bill 3405, page 9 in the report.
Chris, before you do that, we had a high marginal rate from 55 until basically 86. And I can't remember historically what was the impetus for putting that down. We were just coming out of the recession at that time. Did that 10% that was in effect in, let's see, the 10.8% that was in effect 82, 84, did that include the surcharge that was put in for the recession?
Chair Burdick, yeah, the 10.8, the 82 to 84, it was that temporary bump, what has been referred to as a surcharge for those years.
Mm-hmm.
So that was why that 10.8 is higher for the 3 years. That was that temporary tax increase. In 1986, at the federal level, there was a significant overhaul of the federal tax code. Basically, the theme of it was a broadening of the tax base and a lowering of the rates. So that happened in 1986. And then the Oregon legislature responded to that, again, because of our tie to the federal law, by the feds broadening their base, that broadened Oregon's tax base. So Oregon was able to lower the rates a little bit and keep it. I can't recall if the intent was revenue neutral at the time, but it would have been something along those lines. The key piece there, the feds had just broadened the tax base, and our tie to it meant our tax base broadened so we could lower, the legislature could lower the rates and raise the same amount of revenue.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions before we move on to the other bill committee? Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, House Bill 3405, the table 7 on page 9 shows the revenue impacts, and these are just the revenue impacts that you saw during the session on the bill. It's organized according to the minimum tax based on C corporations, S corporations, and partnerships or entities filing as partnerships, so that would include LLCs and so forth. And then the top marginal tax rate. I think you're familiar with this information. One footnote I would highlight on the corporate registry fees, the simply putting this on the ballot delays the implementation of this bill. So that $26 million for 09-11 assumed that those fees would be effective, I think, on October 1st and reflected 21 months of collections during the biennium. Simply by the citizens' referendum, it delays the implementation of that. So we won't be collecting $26 million. These go on the ballot, and if they were passed, then they probably wouldn't take effect until maybe February 1st or March 1st. So that $26 million would be reduced by a few million. Other than that, those numbers are the same that you saw during the session. Table 8 is the chart that shows what the minimum tax is, depending on the Oregon sales level. And we can see it increases from $150 for the smallest corporations, those with less than $500,000 of sales, up to $100,000. Again, it's just a chart for that. Table 9 shows the effect of the proposed tax, well, not the effect of what the proposed tax rates will be over time. And the taxable income levels are for 2009. And so the pre-HB 3405, the 6.6%, reflects our current flat rate on all taxable income. For tax years 2009 and 10, for taxable income less than $250,000, the 6.6% remains, and the 7.9% is applied to taxable income above $250,000. In tax year 11, that 7.9% is reduced to 7.6%. And then in 2013, the 7.6 rate is still in effect, but only applies to taxable income above $10 million rather than from the $250,000.
And that's $10 million in profit, basically.
Taxable income, right.
Okay,
so that's a brief description of the measures. Then the next couple of pages here are the distribution effects. And some of these tables you've seen, but a theme here is to show a distribution effect for tax year 2009, which is the first year that the measures would take effect. and then tax year 2013. And the reason for the difference there is that there are some temporary provisions for the first couple of years. Tax year 2013 is the first year for which the permanent increases exist both on the personal side and the corporate side. So that's the theme of some of the tables. But before I get to that, Table 10 on page 11 shows an assumed distribution of how the unemployment compensation exclusion would affect taxpayers according to AGI. And we see that most of that impact would occur to folks in the lower income range, but it does affect taxpayers at the higher end. And that's because there'll be taxpayers with fairly high income who may lose their job mid-year or toward the end of the year, so there'll be some piece of unemployment income that would be excluded. But that shows the total of $32 million. Then the next table on page 12 shows the distributional impacts of the tax increases, the phase out of the subtraction, as well as the tax rates. And that top portion of the table for tax year 2009, you saw an earlier version of that, slightly different format here. I've collapsed it a little bit to show that the income class of less than $100,000 and then the higher income groups are still separated out. It was just trying to compress everything onto one page for readability. So tax year 2009, those numbers don't change from what you'd seen before. You have, for example, under the all returns, the total row, we have about 37,795 taxpayers that would be affected. That's the 2.5%. And their taxes would go up $162 million. And so that's a 3.7% increase. And then the average is 4,287. But that does vary a lot with income. So for all returns, taxpayers with income of between $100,000 and $200,000 would have an average increase of 466. But that increase rises to just over 15,000 for those with $500,000 of income or more. And again, that's to be expected given the marginal rate structure. The table also shows a mild offset from the federal tax due to the increased deductibility of the higher state taxes. So that's the table for 2009. The lower half is 2013. And the theme here is again, pretty similar, showing the concentration of the impact on the high-income folks. The one thing I would point out is that the average impact falls from 4,287 in 2009 to 2,629. That's driven by the difference in the tax rates, which again is the reason for showing this. The 2009 is the 10.8 and 11%, and 2013 is the 9.9% marginal rate. But otherwise, it's a very similar story in terms of the distributional impact. And then moving on to the distributional impact of the corporate tax increase. On page 14, I have, again, this kind of dual table, 2009 and 2013, for the impact of the minimum tax, corporate minimum tax, and the marginal rate structure, shown separately by Oregon sales. And the 2009 table is very similar to the one you saw during the session. It has the distribution has been modified a little bit. In working with the Department of Revenue, since the close of session, there were some data issues that we were able to clean up. And so the numbers aren't exactly what they were for the table in 2000 that you saw during the session, but they are very similar, and they tell the same story. So for the minimum tax, it's the $46.8 million raised, and overall there's 74% of taxpayers affected. And that percent affected generally declines as Oregon sales increase. So those with less than $500,000 of Oregon sales, about 81% of those taxpayers would be affected by the tax, the new minimum tax. And moving up to the largest corporations, about 45% would be affected by the minimum tax. And for the marginal rate, it raises about $50 million, and about 5% of companies would be affected, and that percentage increases from less than 0.5% for those, the smallest, up to about 54% for the largest corporations. So again, I think you're already familiar with that information. And then the bottom half of the table is tax year 2013, and the minimum tax is very similar. Overall, we're expecting fewer corporation tax returns in 2013 than 2009. But the minimum tax is fairly stable. It's a little bit less, but again, that because of the presence and just the way it's structured, it is the minimum tax, so that won't fluctuate nearly as much as the receipts from the marginal rate. So that's a similar story. In effect, we're expecting fewer returns to be affected in 2013, just a hair, as the economy improves. And then the big difference is in the marginal rate. Here, in 2009, it's $250,000 and above that the rate kicks in. And in 2013, it's only those above $10 million of taxable income. So only about 0.5% of the corporations are affected. But it's about 37% of the largest corporations that are affected.
Madam Chair, before we move on to the next table, just...
Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Chris, you said you expected to have less corporate returns filed in 2013, and the reason being?
Chair Burdick, Senator Telfer. We've been having a long-term trend of fewer C corporations filing tax returns over time. It's falling at about 1% to 2% per year, so it's just assuming that trend continues into the future. And that could be due to mergers of corporations or corporations going from C to S corp, changing the structure. But it's basically just assuming that trend that we've been seeing over the past several years continuing into the future.
And follow-up question or another question.
In your numbers, anticipating what the total tax impact would be, you've considered, other than the reduction in C corporations filing, you haven't taken into account any ramifications of unemployment increasing due to the tax increases or anything like that. You've used static numbers of employment.
Chair Burdick, Senator Telfer, that's correct. These are the static numbers. Paul will be getting to some of the dynamic effects in a bit. And then the last set of tables is the distributional impact across the industrial sectors. And this information is new. And again, the 2009 and 2013 story, the total impacts are the same. It's just broken down by industrial sector. So we can see that for the minimum tax, the concentration of where the effect occurs is in manufacturing, wholesale, and resale trade. That's about almost half of the impact. And then for the marginal rate structure, it's similar. The wholesale, retail, and the finance and insurance sectors would be most affected by the marginal rate piece. And again, it's the same 74% affected by the minimum tax, 5% affected by the marginal rate. In 2013, for the minimum tax, it's, again, largely similar. And then the marginal rate, it's that difference where only 0.5% are affected. But we can see, again, that utilities, for example, have the highest average impact in 2013. But roughly similar stories as before, but this provides an industrial breakdown.
I see. All right, so that's the... That's kind of the end of the corporate part of it.
That's the end of the description and distribution.
To kind of put this in perspective, because already the campaign machines are firing up, and there's been a lot of discussion about how this is going to affect our business climate. And there are groups and organizations that rate states based on their tax structure, among other things, for business. Where do we stand now, and where will we stand if these measures go into effect?
Madam Chair, actually, that's the lead into our next section. And I've got a couple of tables there. It's impact of measures on states' tax burden compared to other states. And first of all, I'll just point out that the caveat for both these tables I have starting on page 16 is that they assume the other states stay the same, and we know they haven't in this current environment, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But if you look at Table 14, this is something that we had done during the session. We've modified it slightly, but basically the same result that if we look at the 05-06 census, and we will be getting new census data coming out very shortly, is my understanding, but 05-06 shows that total taxes were $3,360 per person in that fiscal year, ranked as 34th. What I did was I took the estimates for the measures, not the Secretary of State filing fees, it's not a tax, the two taxes, and grafted them on to those census numbers. And it, you can see that it ended up bumping up our taxes per capita by up to $34.66, and that amount was then compared, put back into the spreadsheet and compared with other states, assuming they stay the same. And you can see that would move our rank to 31st, from 34th to 31st. If you look at the personal income taxes, you can see that our rank stays the same. Corporate would go from 32 to 17. See, corporate taxes are relatively small, $170 per person under the new estimate, $133 under historical. And then as a percent of income, we would go from 38th to 32nd. Personal income taxes, of course, were already very high at second. It would actually bump us to first, again, assuming everybody stays the same. And our corporate would go from 29 to 16. So the bottom line is we would see a slight movement in our rank, but not dramatic in terms of the overall tax burden as a result of the measures. The other issue that has come up, I think that's related to your question, is about the business tax climate. You know, we have emphasized, I think, in our committee meetings, we've had a lot of testimony that taxes are but one of the factors that may affect the business climate. And there are a number of things that obviously have become critical to profitability for businesses and making their location decisions. But if we just narrow it down to the tax piece alone, we think the best study that is done is by Council on State Taxation. It's an annual study done by Ernst & Young. And what they do is they try to include all the business taxes. And you can see the table there on page 15. That's the total for the country, about $590 billion for the 07-08 fiscal year. And the interesting thing, I think, for a lot of people we use corporate and business interchangeably, but really they're not interchangeable. Corporate is...
Just to interrupt for a second, that's table 15 on page 17, correct?
Yes, correct. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and they think, well, corporate income tax is the primary tax that businesses pay, but if you look at the totals nationally, it's less than 10%. The biggest business tax is property taxes. The second business is sales taxes on business-to-business purchases. So that gives you a sense of their estimates of what it is. Now, Oregon, if you look at the next page on page 6, or table 16 on page 18, we had looked at this in this session, but I hadn't had time to incorporate the pass-through part of the 2649. I did incorporate that in this. So, again, these numbers are slightly different. But you can see Oregon has a relatively low burden when you look at business taxes alone. It's 3.7% on the latest Ernst & Young estimates. North Carolina, Connecticut actually has a slightly lower. When it's rounded, it's the same, but it's slightly lower as a percent of the gross state product. And you can see the 10 states that have the lowest percent. And again, keep in mind that this is just because these are the lowest business tax, we're not saying these are the fastest growing states or the best business climate. It's just one aspect. But if we do the same procedure and graft on the effects of the two measures, it would raise our business tax burden to 3.9%, which if everybody else stays the same, would bump us from third lowest to fifth lowest, as both Delaware and Utah would move ahead of us.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. Paul, on table 15, we list the general sales taxes as a tax paid by business, and that's the second largest percentage. But we don't have a sales tax here.
Yes.
So if you factored in the lack of a sales tax, it seems we're comparing apples and oranges in terms of benchmarking us against states that do pay a sales tax, and that's incorporated as a part of would raise their business tax. So if you factor, is there some way to factor that to get a true apples to apples comparison?
Senator Morris, I think, you know, that's certainly a factor and a reason why we have a low ranking. But if you're trying to measure what the burden is, and again, this is a business, it's a burden paid by business directly, and you could argue that there's some tax shifting going on in different systems, but this is the amount of taxes paid by business. So what we're saying is that it's less in Oregon because we don't have a sales tax. It's one of the reasons. But it is interesting, though, too, if you look on the other, if you look on the lowest states, you have Delaware there, who's down with us, who doesn't have a sales tax, but none of the other lowest states, they all have sales taxes. Mm. What we typically see are the states that don't have sales taxes, like Montana, Alaska, both have very high severance taxes, which are paid by business directly. But then you get into the issue of tax shifting, where you know that results in consumers of the product ends up paying the bearing the burden. But in terms of the payment of the tax, it's done by business. And the other non-sales tax state is New Hampshire, which has very high property taxes, and that's why they're not on that list, because those property taxes are even a bigger percentage. So I certainly agree it's one of the factors why we're on that list, but the state for whatever reason has not adopted policies that would offset that with some other business taxes, some other states have done.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you. And Paul, sort of in that vein too, Washington State obviously isn't in the lowest rankings there, but could you say something about, I don't know if you know off the top of your head, where they fall in specifically, it is a sales tax state, but how the gross receipts tax there would affect their ranking compared with the corporate minimum here?
Senator Rosenbaum, it does affect their ranking there. I'll have to look back on the chart, but I believe they're greater than average. The national average is 5.2%. I think they're about 5.4. I'll have to check that. But the B&O tax does show up directly in this study, plus the portion and I'm trying to remember the percent. We've talked to the Washington folks. What they assume is the business portion of the retail sales tax. I believe it's about 25% of what of actually payment. So that the retail sales plus the B&O would both go into the Washington business tax burden, and that's why they're above average.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair, and the B&O, is that capped the way our scheme for the new corporate minimum is?
It's not capped. The B&O is a percent of retail sales, and that percent varies with the type of industry you're in. So what Washington has done has had a higher rate for businesses that they deem to be domestic or not competing across state lines, and those that are more likely to compete across state lines, they have lower rates. So they have that's how their structure is based. I can bring that in for you. It's kind of interesting to look at how, but it's been a product of legislative decisions over the years. But the B&O, I should point out, the B&O base is much broader than the retail sales base. Much broader, about twice as broad as a percentage of the gross state product.
Thank you.
So that gives you a sense that about kind of where the state would go, again, assuming everybody stays the same. The next section that we've tried to look at is the economic effects. I know there's been a lot of discussion about that. And we've tried to put in here what we think we know. We've run some simulations based on some different assumptions for you to look at. We think it highlights what the important factors are. But before I get into that, I have to read a quote out of the latest Economist on that just came out this week, because I think it's very appropriate. It's in the Economics Focus section. Talks about the economists estimating the multiplier for federal fiscal policy. And talks about the disputes and disagreements and what's known about it. And it points out that it says, for example, government spending on building a bridge may have a bigger multiplier than a tax cut if consumers save a portion of their tax windfall, or a tax cut targeted at poor people may have a bigger impact on spending than one for the affluent, because poor folk tend to spend a higher share of their income. And then it goes on and cites some other factors that may influence the multiplier. And then in the end it says, add all this together, and the truth is that economists are flying blind. They can make relative judgments with some confidence, but policymakers looking for precise estimates are deluding themselves. So, with that caveat, I'll talk about what we think. When we look at the economic effects, what we have done is try to divide them into time dimensions. And some of that may create more confusion than it's worth, but I do have a table on table 17 that tries to break out what those time elements are. And I think for our purposes, the most important element is the short-term business cycle environment in which we, as an economy, as a state economy, are way below our capacity. We got 12% unemployment. Obviously, we could produce a lot more with the existing resources we have. The limiting factor under these conditions is demand. There's insufficient demand in the system. And, of course, what the federal government's trying to do is run big deficits to try to beef up demand. I mean, that's the whole strategy right now. Now, states are in a position where they can't do that. And then most people would probably say that's a good thing. And you have to balance your operating budget in the short term. And what that means is the method you choose to balance your operating budget necessarily has a negative effect on demand. Either you reduce spending or you increase revenue, both of which has the effect of pulling dollars out of the spending stream. So if you're looking at just a short-term analysis, whatever you do in terms of the budget balancing will tend to have a negative effect. One of the very consistent patterns we have seen is that states tend to raise taxes in recessions. We handed out a time series of the NCSL survey of tax measures at your last meeting, and it consistently shows in the late 90s states were cutting taxes because they had surpluses and the economy was booming. In the 2001-03 recession, they raised taxes. And in this current fiscal year, NCSL survey shows an estimate of combined estimate of an increase of $24 billion of all the states combined for the 2009-10 fiscal year. And about $10 billion of that is in personal income taxes. So the states are raising taxes. The effect is to slow the economy. Well, that's one of the factors that forecasters build in. State and local governments are pro-cyclical because of their budget balancing requirements. So now having said that, the next issue is, okay, do spending reductions tend to decrease economic or do spending reductions or taxes tend to decrease economic activity more? In the short term, I think the evidence is, and in theory it's consistent, that spending decreases would tend to reduce economic activity more than tax increases. And there are two simple reasons for that. One is that the spending decreases are taken directly out of the spending stream. A tax increase slows the economy in the short term by reducing disposable income, a portion of which comes out of savings or what economists call leakages. This is back to this multiplier discussion. So the multiplier effect for a tax increase is less than the multiplier effect for a spending decrease. So in other words, they both slow the economy in the short term, but in theory, the spending decrease would slow it more. The other interaction with taxes and spending is with federal fiscal policy. And Chris showed in one of your charts the estimated reductions in federal taxes from the tax increases. Well, that's from the deductibility. Now, a lot of people can't do that now under the alternative minimum, and that's muting some of that effect. But that has a softening effect on the short-term impact of taxes on demand. On the other side, on the spending side, the impact of spending reductions can be exaggerated by matching effects. So if you cut spending in one area, that leads to reduced matching funds from the federal government, then you have an exaggerating effect. So it's for those reasons we think that a spending decrease has a larger impact on demand, or spending decrease has a larger negative impact on demand than a tax increase does. All of this is in the short term. And we think that, the state fiscal policy effects that you're looking at are negative, but they're relatively small. And we've got Tom Petowski here, and he can tell you how much he factors those into his forecast. But I think what he'll tell you is, overwhelmingly, the most important factor in his short-term forecast is the national business cycle and what's going on with that. That's going to overwhelm most of the things that you would do in terms of fiscal policy in the short term. If the national economy begins recovering, we will too. If it doesn't, we won't. And that's been the historical pattern, pretty consistent. So that's kind of what we think in terms of the short term. The next question we've tried to address is what happens in the longer term when we look at these measures and we take the permanent or longer term elements of them that Chris went through with you, the 9.9% for the higher marginal personal income tax rate, the 7.6% on $10 million for the corporate income tax rate. And what we've done is we've looked at two different, we're calling them time periods, but if you look on page 22, you can see some simulations that we've run looking through our Oregon tax incidence model that we designed some 10 years ago. And we use it to look at not short-term movements. It's not a forecasting model. We're not looking at what's going to happen in the next year. What we're trying to look at is what's going to happen over time when the economy recovers. How would these measures affect Oregon's productive capacity? Now, what that means in for economists is we look at the supply side factors and not the demand side factors in this longer-term scenario. So the issue is, how do these measures affect the state's competitive position or productive capacity? Well, the issue we've had with OTIM is that OTIM can track through behavioral effects, so the wages and prices on the economy. What we have assumed in the past is that the public spending that results from those increases has no impact on productivity. Well, if you think about it over time, that assumption is not realistic. If you spend money on education, it should increase the productivity of your labor force over time. So what we've done is we've run two simulations, and you can see them on table 18. And we're calling them one intermediate, one longer term, but you could just think of them. That's the assumption that's changed is, in simulation one, there are no productivity gains from public spending in the intermediate. There are no productivity gains from public spending. So you could think of that as the public sector is spending this on consumption. It's not investing in anything that would improve the productivity of the economy. If you run through that analysis, you can see our results is we get relatively modest changes in income and employment. They're negative, but they're about 0.1% in terms of personal income and employment. Return to capital goes down. It has a negative effect on investment. Price level, it goes up a bit as a result of primarily the corporate minimum. And you do see some out-migration occurring in that simulation. So the simulation one, I think, is relevant if the public expenditures have no impact on productivity. Simulation two looks at an alternative where there are productivity gains resulting from the public spending. And the way this worked technically is we have public expenditures as a component of the production function of the industries in OTIM. So normally that coefficient is turned off. So we turned it on and said, okay, there is a positive feedback effect. The public sector uses some of these dollars to invest in education and infrastructure and other components we know increase productivity in the economy. And basically what we're showing under simulation two is what negative effects you see in terms of net employment and income can be negated and theoretically can even be turned positive if those investments increase productivity enough. So the bottom line for our long-term analysis on the overall economy is the net effect depends on how that revenue is used. If it's used in a way that improves the productivity of the economy and enhances the state's competitive position, it could be the negative effects can be neutralized or more than offset. So that's kind of the message of OTIM. It's not a simple, it's good or bad. And then the answer, I know, is a little bit disappointing that it depends, but very much it does. And that's why you don't see real consistent relationships between state tax burden and state economic growth. It's because other factors come into play. And ultimately, the key factor is not so much what the tax burden is, but what the state uses those dollars to uses those tax dollars for. If they don't use them effectively, the IR tax burden obviously becomes a big negative. If they do, then it can be neutral, even positive. So that's kind of the result of our analysis. OTIM has the capability of adjusting for these public sector effects. The real empirical question is, well, how big is that coefficient? The answer is we don't really have a very precise answer for that. And I'll have to go back to my quote that I'd be deluding you if I said I have a precise answer to that, because we don't. But that is what it depends on. And so at least our models are able to show what the key factors are. They also have kind of an interesting look at the distribution effects by households, and that's on table 19. And you can see under simulation 1, we do have a smaller population, but you notice even though we have the lower net income, this is after-tax income and after wages and prices have changed, so it would include any shifting that would go on, and we think that's why you get a slight negative for the low-income group in terms of average net household income because of the price level increase. But notice that the average net household income increases for all the groups with the exception of the above 185,000. So that's kind of building in the dynamic effects. It reinforces, confirms the static effects in the distributional sense. And you see you get a reduction in the number of households above 185,000, suggesting not so much that they're going to decline, but rather the growth in that group would be less than it would be otherwise. Otherwise, all of these numbers are compared to some long-run hypothetical forecast out there, so they're not from today's numbers. If you look at simulation 2...
Hold on, Paul. Senator Rosenbaum.
And just before you leave that chart, Paul, so that the out-migration effects, which I assume means people might move somewhere else, does that take into account what you said earlier about all these other states that are also looking at revenue increases of their own?
Let me say, I don't mean necessarily out-migration, even though I may use that. It means that there is less net in-migration than there would be otherwise, because Oregon is obviously a net in-migration state in all of our forecasts. So, that's held constant. The way OTIM is designed, it's OTIM looks at Oregon, and the rest of the world is held constant. So, and that's just a simplification that's necessary to make it manageable. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. The rest of the world's going to be changing. And, it gets to the issue of what kinds of structural changes do we see in state fiscal policy as a result of this, pretty traumatic recession we've been in? And it could be that we see some long-term changes that could change some of the relationships, particularly in the West Coast. So, but anyway, that gives you a sense, I think, and I've put these longer time horizons out here just because not so much that we have strong empirical evidence as how long it takes for public spending to affect productivity, but just because we intuitively think it's going to take longer when you think about the elements like early childhood education or any types of education expenditures could well take 10 to 15 or up to 20 years to fully affect productivity. And we would expect the tax effects through influencing migration behavior of high-income households probably occur sooner, take less time. And then I'll just finish up by with our budgetary consequences, and then Tom and his folks are going to come up, and Tom has done a lot of research on this issue around migration and high-income households. So he's going to kind of try to flush that out. I think it's consistent with our results, but he'll talk about what the literature says and what they've seen based on the data they have. The final piece we have here is the budgetary consequences. The impact of the S vote is the September forecast would stay in place. Chris already mentioned to you there would be one change. We would have to reduce that revenue estimate for the Secretary of State filing fees because of the timing. But compared to the September forecast, what would happen as a result of a no vote is we would take $733 million out of that forecast. And I think you've seen the reserve position at our last meeting. Table 21 shows what that would look like in the event of a no vote and everything else the same. You'd go from a $94.8 million projected ending balance to a $638 million projected ending balance. And then the trigger that we talked about at our last committee meeting for the state school fund transfer of $200 million would be negated. You wouldn't meet the criteria for that trigger, obviously. So you'd have a $638 million shortfall, but you would also have about $300 million in reserves if you look at projected revenue in the Education Stability Fund and the Rainy Day Fund, which you wouldn't use for the trigger now, so you'd have some more Rainy Day Fund available. So that gives you a sense kind of what the arithmetic would look like on the morning after a no vote with everything else the same. Final thing I wanted to mention to you, and I will spend some more time on this, but because I think it is important particularly for your next topic in today's meeting, and that is the long-run impact of the measures, if they're approved by voters, on the state's revenue elasticity. We've talked a lot in this committee about, and in the restructuring task force, about the elasticity of the personal income tax. Elasticity means you have strong growth over time, a high income elasticity. It generally means it's progressive, but it also means it's volatile. And so what we would anticipate in terms of these measures is they would increase the elasticity of the system through the personal income tax, increase the volatility, and emphasize reserve policy, which, of course, is your next topic. The effects of 3405 on reserves are a little bit trickier because the corporate income tax is volatile in the short run, but its long-run elasticity is low because it's generally shrunk as a share of the economy for a whole variety of reasons. So it has a relatively low long-run elasticity. The corporate minimum, we think, would have a low elasticity, both short and long-run, would actually be a stabilizing influence in the short term because, obviously, corporations have to pay it whether they're profitable or not, so you'd have this steady flow of income. But it would also grow very slowly over time, so it would have a low elasticity over time. So that's kind of our thoughts on how things would go in the long term. And we're open to any questions, or we can have the state economist come up.
Okay, well, we've got you captive, so committee, you can ask some questions now, but we will also might have more questions for you when we hear the other panel.
Okay, all right.
Okay, Office of Economic Analysis, you are on, Mr. Patowski.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, members of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Patowski with the Office of Economic Analysis. Also with me today from the Office of Economic Analysis is Josh Lehner. So what we're going to do today is basically following up what Paul's presentation provided you. And as in a general statement, I would say that we are in general agreement with all of Paul's analysis that we saw today. And we're going to mostly concentrate on sort of the migration issues that are out there. Now, I'm going to be fairly quick to this so that you can get back on schedule and you can ask some questions. So I'll just go through the slides very quickly. And if you need to ask questions, please do so. Also, we have no desire to delude you today, and we won't disappoint you in that regard. Taxes and economic growth. This is sort of a broad issue that we looked at, and really the broad issue here is, states that have generally higher taxes relative to lower states with lower taxes, what happens to their economic growth over time? And there's been lots of issues in the literature about this, so we looked over a number of studies. But there are a couple of issues that have to be related here. It's definitely a long-run view, as Paul was describing with OTIM. You actually have to control for all sorts of other factors that could affect states' growth paths other than just what are the differences in taxes. And also, as Paul mentioned, you have to look at both sides of the coin. You have to look at not only what the tax changes are and what type of tax, who's being taxed, but also on the spending side. What do you do with those taxes? And where are they spent will make a big difference. And then you have to ascertain what's the mobility of economic resources. If, for example, if you have a high tax on high-income filers, do these high-income people vote with their feet and move or not? So the stat, what we found, this is just a general summary. Most of these studies find that there's a negative link between taxes and economic growth. But this negative impact tends to be relatively small on growth. But you want to keep in mind, these are long-run studies. They aren't what we call event studies, which is, for example, we have the two measures that are going to be voted on in January. Those are event studies in the sense that here is a change. What is the impact? This is more a much longer-run view of the relative positions of states. But so that's just a quick summary of really what we found between economic growth and taxes among states. The migrational issues, the sort of overriding question, does high-income tax rates induce high-income residents to move? There's a lot of issues in that being able to give you precise answers is very, very difficult, if not impossible. So our strive is to at least be loosely correct in the area rather than giving you a precisely incorrect answer. Very lack of data. You need to isolate decision factors of why people do move from county to county or state to state. There's many various reasons for that. The Employment Department did a study back in 1999, and they sort of listed that things like job, friends and family seem to be one of the strongest reasons for why people move. And then we got to realize that income levels of high-income groups, they're very highly volatile. So that the same people that may, in the study, may be considered as high-income, the next year they may not be high-income anymore. And people that weren't high-income before now fall into that group. So just being able to follow someone over time is relatively difficult in these studies. We're going to present you with a couple of characteristics here. This comes from American Economic Survey, the micro data for 2005-2007, and just some of the factors that affect migrations. And so these numbers are just related to people that have moved into the state and people that move out of the state. And as you can see, overall, we're definitely a net in-migrating state. More people come into our state domestically than leave the state. You can see that also that's true with the higher the level of education. We tend also to have more people tending to move in at these higher levels of education than moving out. And that's not a surprise. We've known for a long time. We've sort of suspected Oregon imports our education rather than produce it domestically. Age groups, once again, the 25 to 44 age group, Joe Courtwright, economist, sort of talked about this as the young and the restless. We definitely attract that age group more so. And we're net migration into the state for all age groups. Some retirement income. We find here that relatively more people are net migrators in if they do have some retirement income as opposed to no retirement income. And then we get to the other tougher issues on incomes, family income, and household income. And you can see when we start to slice this up, and we sliced it up based on some of the tax levels that we're looking at these measures, family income from $125,000 to $250,000 and then $250,000 plus. Notice the $250,000 plus. Here, it's showing that we have more people out-migrating than in-migrating. during these years into the state. So that still have more in migrating going up to the 250,000 level for family income, but 250,000 plus a few more out migration. Household income, a little different than family income, because now household income can include the one-person household. So it includes both the family income and also single people. And a similar type of analysis occurs here. So whether this is actual evidence or not, we've not been able to take a look, have the time to see if this is a sequence over a long period of time. Is this something just naturally that happens for Oregon or not? Or is this unique to just this period of time? We then did analysis of what's called logistic regression analysis. And what it does is it tries to calculate the probability of things happening. And here the probability we're trying to get at is what's the probability of a person moving out of the state. And it basically takes the data you saw in the previous analysis and then puts it into this regression type analysis. And some of the characteristics, higher education levels, they're more likely to move in and out. Higher education people tend to be more mobile, which is what you would expect. Age, the older are less likely to move in and move out compared to the 18 and 24-year age group. You're more established in an area. You have more connections, less reason to move. Any retirement income, you're more likely to move in, less likely to move out compared to the group that does not have retirement income. And then finally, on the wage and salary greater than $100,000, we find that this group, relative to people that make less than $100,000, they're less likely to move into the state, but also they're less likely to move out of the state. So once again, it doesn't give you a true demarcation here of the probability of people in these age groups of how they move. But once again, the feeling is that with over $100,000 income, you may have more connections, ties to the area that you're at, and thus less likely to move in from someplace else, but also once you're here, less likely to move out. These are migration patterns, 2000 to 2006, cumulative. You'll notice that definitely the highest net migration, and by the way, this is net, so the people, we have people moving out of Oregon to these states and people moving into these states and regions. So it's a positive net. More people are moving into Oregon than Oregonians moving to California by quite a large amount. The negative net migrations are to Washington and to Idaho. And we might say that this is not basically a new pattern. To give you a sort of a micro sense of this, we took a look at Multnomah County and Clark County. And we went back just to 1992. But every year, 1992 through 2006, there's been a negative net migration. More people moved out of Multnomah County to Clark than moved Clark to Multnomah. So through economic conditions, business cycles, and so on, this has just been a pattern that's occurring. And, you know, aspects for this, you know, Multnomah County is pretty well built up already. If it's going to grow and so on, the possibilities of growing are easier across the river than in the area itself. Notice we're positive nets to most of the regions around the country here. And I'll just leave it at that. But also, we're going to keep in mind, this is where it's hard to get precise numbers. You know, we're here at a level of almost like 35% of the statistics that we have are unknown as to what their state of origin was. So that clouds some of these numbers. High-income filers. This comes from our actual tax filers in the state of Oregon from the Oregon Department of Revenue. This just tells you that, and these, by high-income filers, we're meaning those that are single filers that are making above $150,000 and joint filers above $250,000. And one of the interesting parts here is that, you know, this definitely falls during the recession period, but you can see that it also grows in expansion periods. And the 2007 level of filers is more than twice what they were back in 2003. This is taking those group of high-income filers and breaking them down into three other categories, those that are below $1 million, but still the high-income group, $1 million to $10 million, above $10 million. And you can see very small numbers are in the very, very high-income groups. Notice, though, how these numbers move very much following sort of a business cycle movement also. And we're doing this, too, because we don't want to make excuses for our general fund revenue forecast, but a very small group of people can make a relatively large difference in what the revenues are that come into the state. Okay, characteristics. Incomes are very volatile, but they closely follow the business cycle is one aspect. And we'll have a slide just in a second to show what's the relative contribution of this group to when we see the overall tax liabilities change for the state. And then roughly one-third are not Oregon high-income filers the next year. They fall out of that group. Although nearly 95% of this group always file a tax return each year. So here are the high income filers. This is contribution to net change. So in 2001, the high income group basically was responsible for close to 80% of the change in the general fund tax liability for that year. That did come down, but also it's come up again in 2007 up to about 60%. So this group really pushes around our taxes. This a little hard to see here. This purple is all Oregon filers that are high-income filers. And so they're still filing. And then after 3 years, we come down to about 80%. So somewhere a little less than 20% of the high-income filers are not filing in Oregon after 3 years. Those that remain as high-income filers after 3 years, only 30% of the original group are left. So what's happening within the group is that it's a very their income levels are very volatile. So people are moving in and out of this group quite rapidly. So after a three-year period, we're down to only, you know, 30% are left. Although they're still here mostly, because you can see that stableness across all these years, the purple, they're still here, but they're still filing, but they're not filing as necessarily high-income filers. So this is what we know and don't know about high-income Oregonians. Around 1.5% of the personal income tax filers, these high-income group, account for 16% to 28% of total personal income tax liabilities for the tax years 2000 to 2007. So a very small group of filers representing a relatively large amount. Your high-income tax filers, they've contributed over 50% of the change in tax collections, and the contribution becomes higher during both recessions and during the boom periods. We note, we've shown you that over 3 years, only half to a third remain the same filers in the high-income group. We did show you, though, that we found that in this American Community Survey, we had more high-income households left the state than have moved in during the years 2005-2007. Though, of all the migrants that are out there, these numbers are relatively small. Then we have from the tax filer data, we have, though, that the tax statistics show that high-income filers in the state more than doubled from 2003 to 2007. And also from our other logistic model, the high wage and salary households are less likely to move in, but they're also less likely to move out of the state. Basically, it's the idea wherever you're at, you have more of a stake in where you're at.
And a lot of the volatility, or probably most of the volatility, is due to the impact of capital gains. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Chair Burdick. Most likely that probably is what's moving things around, because that we also noticed from our tax returns that tends to be one of the more volatile items, definitely more volatile than, you know, wage and salary income, and that it could be enough just to push these people in and out of these categories.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Morris.
Are you concluded?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to refer back to page 6, the Oregon net migration flows. It seems to me that out-migration as per this statistic of your high-income votes, is a very significant statistic. And I believe there was a committee that met yesterday that dealt with the issue of venture capital. And Oregon has a low standing of venture capital available for entrepreneurial activities. Is there any correlation, possibly, between the fact that we have a, what appears to be a pretty significant out-migration of people that have accumulated, the high-income people, and the lack of venture capital?
Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, the difficult part on these sort of descriptive statistics is exactly what you're getting at. You know, what is the explanation for them? That is a possible explanation for that. Once again, we in a time that we've looked at, we don't know if this is something that is a more recent aspect or something that's been going on for a while. And unfortunately, we can't get at it because the American Community Survey, the data really only becomes somewhat better because they've broadened out what they look at the state as we got to 2005. So I don't know, you know, Is this been happening for a while or not happening for a while? Is a tough question to answer, and then the reasons for it are really speculative at this point.
All right, other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We'll try to get a little bit more back on schedule here today. Our next panel will be on the Rainy Day Fund Revenue Source. And Paul, why don't you introduce that?
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we've got put a few things in your packet related to this issue. It was one that you have as really your top interim work plan issue, and that is to look at the reserve fund situation in terms of what could potentially be a long-term revenue source. What I've done is copied the recommendation that was provided January of 2009 from the Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring. I just copied that directly so you can have that in front of you and what the task force had to say. The other thing that I did on the back of that page, and those of you who are on the task force remember, one of the things we did was compute the standard deviation for the forecast. And so since we have one more, I have to wait till Tom leaves before I... we do have some new numbers because 0709 is over, and so what I did was go back and recalculate the standard deviation on the two components of the 2% surplus kicker calculation. Remember, that's corporate income taxes, but the other category is everything else. So it's predominantly personal, but it can also be the cigarette taxes and estate taxes and the other components. So you can see the calculation there is an 0709. The non-corporate piece was a little over $1 billion less than was the forecast at close of session, and that was about 8.5% low. And the standard deviation, it was result of that was to increase the standard deviation from the calculation the task force looked at, and now it's estimated it's 6.3% based on that 81 to 09 period. And the task force recommendation, one of the things they talked about was if you use some kind of a guidance for a margin of error, you know, should it, you look over time and what kind of time period should you use. But that gives you a sense of how that's changed. On the corporate side, actually the standard deviation went down a little bit, even though the forecast was $236 million below the projection. That projection includes the contribution to the rainy day fund from the corporate kicker. From the previous biennium, but you can see it's about 25% low, and over time that's about 33% as a standard deviation. The other thing I would point out is that the non-corporate piece, which is the vast bulk of the revenue, the average when you cancel out the negatives and the positives, is only about 1.5%. So what that tells you is the forecast over time is relatively unbiased, but there's a large variance in each forecast, either up or down. So that, of course, is one of the primary motivations for a reserve fund. The last piece I have in your packet is SGR 29, which, as you recall, was introduced last session, and I just have that there for your reference.
Got some great names on this bill. Okay.
And then, Madam Chair, we've asked Tim Nesbitt from the Governor's Office to talk about, as he was a help staff that the Revenue Restructuring Task Force and worked on the report and a lot to do with this recommendation.
Well, yeah, I would go even further than that and call him our intellectual guru on this very important recommendation. So I wanted to ask you back for an update, Tim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tim Nesbitt. I'm Deputy Chief of Staff for the Governor and was involved, as Paul said, with your Revenue Restructuring Task Force. I wanted to make two points this morning. One is the renewed importance and urgency of dealing with this issue, given what's happened to our reserves. And secondly, some further explanation of how we arrived at the amounts you see in SGR 29 and how we've actually conceptualized the issue and actually the proposal that we might yet see go to the voters. On the first point, in Paul's prior presentation on page 25, he didn't call attention to it, but there you can see the evidence that's obvious that we're drawing down our reserves. At the start of this year, when the governor prepared his recommended budget, we were looking at projected reserves of $734 million. I remember in the task force we were looking at numbers which suggested we may be on track to get to something like 10% of our biennial budget in reserve funds comprised of both the Education Stability Fund and the Rainy Day Fund. Obviously, we've since then been drawing down those reserves at a very rapid rate. And even if the revenue measures are sustained in January, there's that transfer that will occur of $200 million to schools, which I think a lot of people are counting on. There's been that further loss of revenue projected for this biennium, all of which means that by June of next year, Paul's figures here actually go out to June of 2011, but by June of next year, what I call the dipstick moment, when you measure to see if you have enough, in fact, to provide that $200 million to schools, if everything holds, we'll be down close to about $100 million at that point, less than 1% of your budget. So that's quite a shift in a short period of time, and we all know why, because it's been an unprecedented recession. But I think that just raises the question then of the urgency and importance of how to attend to the challenge of rebuilding that rainy day fund. What the task force did was look at three elements, two of which we easily reached consensus on. Actually, we reached consensus on all three, but two that I think are given now is that we have a good sense of the size of the fund needed. The task force recommended a rainy day fund of 10% rather than the 7.5% in statute now. Combined with the Education Stability Fund, it would get us 15% of the budget. Perhaps a stronger case can be made now after this year's experience that should be even higher. I think another significant finding in that report is that we would probably be having to set aside 3 to 4% of our revenues from biennium to biennium in order to get to that level of reserves in a reasonable period of time. But certainly the size of the fund, target of 15%, I think was became a consensus target. The terms for accessing and distributing the funds, pretty much nobody was trying to rethink or redo the legislation that created the Rainy Day Fund. So with the exception of some of the timing questions of when you measure what's available and when the budget needs are triggered, there's pretty much agreement on the parameters you've already established in the statutes that established the Rainy Day Fund. The source of funding was a big challenge. There was a discussion about ongoing sources of funding as well as occasional sources of funding, i.e. the kind that would come from higher than expected revenues in good times. And I would say that although occasional sounds speculative, you can pretty much count on the fact that when we have an economic recovery, our revenues are going to exceed what we projected. More often than not, that's that standard deviation. Back to the ongoing source of revenue, there is the ending balance provision right now. It's only generating $11 million this biennium. Could do certainly more than that in future biennia, depending on spending in future budgets. The and now we have House Bill 2073, which will set aside, in I think beginning in 2013, a portion of the increased corporate taxes. So that's certainly an unexpected and beneficial source. I think it's something like $60 million of biennium in the first biennium, Paul. But certainly that's not large enough to get us back to where we need to be to provide the stability we need to avert or at least moderate future fiscal crises in the event of future recessions. That leads to what Paul called the standard deviation, and in layman's terms, that really means the amount by which we've been wrong in the past and expect to be wrong again in the future. And so that number has moved around a little bit. I think it was an important calculation to make because we want to be able to talk about a redirection of these higher-than-expected revenues at certain times in amounts that don't appear to be arbitrary. So Paul now has given you new estimates. About 6.3% is the amount by which we've underestimated revenues on average in the past, 33% from the corporate. And those amounts were reflected, or actually the earlier iterations of those amounts were reflected in SJR 29. Another term arises in SJR 29, which I think is going to be important for communicating this concept to the voters, and that is the idea of a mandated or mandatory savings rate. That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about setting aside a portion of revenues when revenues are higher than expected and not budgeted at that level, to do exactly what voters in survey after survey tell us they want done, and that is to have a adequate reserve so that we're not whipsawed in these in the business cycle and in the down times having to cut budgets the way we have had this time, or in some cases having to raise taxes. That's the stability we're all seeking, and I think the concepts here are solid. That it's going to take constitutional amendment, which means there's going to have to be that conversation with the voters about the concept here. There's an opportunity here with a constitutional amendment, and that is that you can at the same time put the rainy day fund, now statutory, into the Constitution and gain the added assurance that goes with that mechanism being one that can't be changed from legislative session to legislative session. That, combined with the idea of a mandatory savings rate, I think is what is becoming now more urgent than ever. Thank you.
Thank you. And this may be out of line because of political, and tell me if it is, but you know what, we're going to most likely have these measures on the ballot in January, and there's been some discussion about just the impact of the election itself on the voters and whether this is the best time to put something like this out. Have you thought about this? Do you have any thoughts on just the general climate in terms of February for doing this?
Well, it's the hand we've been dealt, Senator, and I think we've seen shifts in public opinion every 3 to 6 months in the past, and this is certainly a time in which the economy is still not getting positive reviews in all the consumer sentiment surveys. There's still a lot of unease and fear about everybody's own economic situation. But I think that actually, with what I just outlined for you in terms of how you are spending down your reserves responsibly, I think, over the course of this biennium, your case is all the stronger for why you need these revenues to maintain the services. And I think the earlier testimony today supports that.
Thank you. Didn't mean to put you on the spot. Are there other questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment and possibly a question. The fact that we need a rainy day fund that is truly robust and adequate, without exception, all 90 members plus the governor agree and generally accepted in the public. It's how we charge that rainy day fund that becomes problematic, the policy that we set. Now, SGR 29 kind of took that middle of the road. We did have a mandated savings rate of funds, plus we are taking a portion of the kicker. And it's that kicker issue that tends to rise up and say, you're stealing my kicker, you're raising my taxes, and it becomes a negative very quickly. Do you sense that in February, that if these referendums succeed and the taxes are overturned, that there would be a will of the body to even move forward for possibly a November election, a revision of that kicker? Or is there a potential to come back and maybe take less of the kicker and have more of a mandated savings rate, something that will find that balance that this body would adopt and the public would accept?
Senator, I don't know how I can answer your question. I mean, obviously, there are a number of outcomes possible. Both measures could be sustained. Both could fail. One or both could be sustained. I think even the opposition to the measures, though, are many of the advocates for repeal of one or both of these measures are at the same time saying, but we need more revenue and we need a more stable revenue system. So I hope there's still the possibility for consensus on those points.
Okay. I'm not done, but I will be done.
Well, you can go as long as you want.
This is one of the most important things that we can be dealing with in the future, is to provide that stability and find a way that does it in a meaningful way. Right now, the system we have is not meaningful. It does not meet the needs. We can't build a rainy day fund fast enough with what we have in place. It begs a solution. And my hope is that irrespective of what happens in February, or in January, that in February we will come to grips with this issue and find a solution for Oregon. I can think of nothing more important for us to tackle in February.
Well said. Senator Hess.
Thank you. This is just adjacent to that issue, and that is the cost of distributing kicker checks. Have you calculated the cost, including borrowing and postage and all those things? Do you have?
I know it's been calculated, Senator. Maybe
Paul
would know the number.
Paul, you want to address that?
Senator Hess, yes, we've gone through and calculated the amount of distributing the checks. The cost of the Department of Revenue is right around $1 million. And the main cost, though, we've had, particularly with the last kicker, is the fact that the refund goes out early in the biennium, before the tax collections start to come in. And what that does is force the Treasury to issue tax anticipation notes, or TANs. And then there's an interest cost associated with that. My recollection, I think it was in the neighborhood of $30 million with the last relatively large kicker. That's all. I can get that back. In fact, the chair has asked me to get that information together again. I'll provide that for the committee. And
yeah, we had that presented at an early
committee
some time ago.
Yeah, I knew it was that rather staggering amount, and that it would argue for just doing a tax credit at tax time versus the physical check going out. I mean, it wouldn't change anything to the taxpayer or the receiver of the kicker, but it just seems like it would make a lot more sense.
That's definitely on the radar screen of the chair. As a matter of fact, the chair on my first session in revenue had a bill to do that, and the governor's office hijacked it.
Let me take a note on that one.
For another worthy cause. So it's definitely something we need to consider, because throwing away $30 million just so people can have a check is a dubious proposition in these budget times. Other questions? Senator Rosenbaum?
No. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Telfer? Okay. Thank you very much, Tim. Okay. Now, another non-controversial item that we have before us, video lottery retailer comes.
And then we're going to get our economist for advice.
Oh, I'm...
NASM could go up.
Oh, okay.
And on that back side is the next topic.
Oh, it's all this about video? All right.
Okay, we are joined by the vice guru here. Nathan, why don't you start us off on this project? We just a little background. There was a hearing before the Lottery Commission on this issue, and a number of us testified at that hearing, some of whom will be here today, and I just wanted to have some of those same people here to present the issue in this venue so that we can give it a little broader consideration. So, Mazen, go ahead.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, just to put a background for additional background to the background you've just went through. I'm sure you remember from the time of the 2009 session, it feels like we never left, doesn't it? The lottery presentation that we had at that time had some information about the video compensation rates. And at that time, we went through the way that we used to do the old rates. This is in the packet that I've given you. Old rates as it was at the time before 2004. This is at the average blended rate of 32%. Then this went through change with the 2004. And as you see at the bottom of the table, the blended rate then went down to 28 to 29%. And, of course, the new contract that came in 2005 for the poker and line games also changed the structure for the rates, and that went down the estimated blended rate from 22% to 26%. With the caveat that in 2007, if sales exceeds $805,000 because of line games, that was a clause in the contract, things would change again to, and that will be the annual blended rate 21 to 25%. That's the backdrop of the rates as they are being discussed and negotiated, renegotiated this time. And just to put in perspective what kind of view the revenue from the lottery actually comes to be, you have this one view of lottery where you have gross revenue coming on a straight line, and in the axis, in the bottom, the x-axis, saying that retailers' compensation, and here's you go from 1% to 96%. So basically what we're saying is the more forward or higher the compensation, the net revenue, of course, will come lower and lower in the sloping, downward sloping line. That's one way of course, looking at revenue as it comes. And just to show that the retailer compensation could be looked at in a different way, where you have the gross revenue is actually a sloping upward curve, if you will, a curving line. And this curving line is going upward as an outcome of the marketing and the work that the retailers do. And therefore, the more you would go with the retailer compensation on the bottom axis, you would have an increase to a point where you have the marginal return high in an economic point of view, and then it keeps going down. Now, remember, the best of two worlds is when we put these two things together and these lines meet. Once we have those lines meet, this is for economists, where we would maximize revenue and minimize cost in that sense. However, those points of meeting of the lines, if you will, are probably the discussion that you have alluded to and the discussion that have always come between the one side versus the other side. And here today, in order to help navigate the point where we reach those meeting of the lines, you would have the director of the lottery. We invited here today, Dale Penn. And then after he's done with giving you an overview and a way of update of how things are going on that front, we have the, basically an argument for the two sides of the equation, or the representing the two sets of lines, if you will. And we'd ask the director to come up and give you a presentation of what he has. And he furnishes this piece of information, the page that has the video lottery retail commissions.
Okay. Why don't you come on up, Dale? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
It's a little bit
good
more
morning.
Antique than the fairgrounds.
Yeah. For the record, my name is Dale Penn. I'm director of the lottery, and this issue of video lottery retailer commissions is one that I came to the lottery about 5 years ago, and within 6 weeks of becoming the director, found myself in the middle of the last discussion we had on this, which generated line games, an amendment to the contract, the look-back rule, which accomplished some of the reductions in retailer commissions that your council was just advising you of. The challenge for the commission, I'll just quickly give you a little bit of factual information on this one page and describe the process for you. The challenge for the commission is a clear direction that their goal is to maximize revenue for the public good. And specifically as it comes in line with this particular expense, it is only one expense out of many, albeit it is a large expense, the commissions that are provided to video lottery retailers. But in that process of trying to maximize revenues, there is a mandate to give a reasonable rate of return to retailers. But even more importantly, I think when you look at the mandate to maximize revenues, is the idea of the motivation of, in effect, your sales force. Because retailers really are the sales force for this product. And originally, when this product went on the market, the state of Oregon, in effect, with its commission rate, purchased the ability from retailers to utilize their customers to sell this product, lottery products. That was really how this started, and that's kind of how it started throughout the world. But there is constantly this challenge of how do you have a motivated sales force to drive your sales and maximize revenues, and yet also try to make sure that you confine expenses. So that is the challenge, and I think that's the graph that was shown to you. It is $1 billion of revenue, and so it's very important that we must preserve that revenue, that $1 billion source, plus attempt to grow it and not do something to endanger that basic revenue that the state relies upon. Now, in that challenge, we now have a unique period of time presently. We have the economy, and that has had an impact on lottery sales and certainly an impact on the ability of our retailers to stay in business and to operate their businesses. We have high unemployment in the state of Oregon. And I'm not telling you anything new. I'm just saying both of those things have impacts on this issue. And then the third issue is the smoking ban. Clearly, the smoking ban impacts the ability to sell gambling products. Now, there's a wise policy decision to have the smoking ban. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not criticizing that decision. It's just there's many positive reasons for a smoking ban. The one negative impact, no matter where this has been imposed throughout the world, is it drops gambling revenues for a period of time. So we're in the middle of that now, dealing with some of that dropped revenues. It is a little bit complicated in Oregon with the idea that there are still gambling establishments where smoking is allowed. And so yesterday, I believe, the Oregonian had an editorial about the issue of Native American casinos and the ability to smoke. And clearly our retailers would say they have lost a number of core players who are close to casinos. And angry about that, concerned about it, and certainly for the short term, that is an impact. Whether or not it will be in the long term, I don't know. I hope not, from my perspective. But with that overview, those are the challenges I think the Commission faces. I've tried to give you a quick synopsis of some data, and it's already been detailed for you maybe in my earlier presentations or the graphs we've given, but these are the actual amounts. 2004, the Commission rate, all year long, average, every retailer, average Commission rate, 31.85. And then a new contract began in 2005. It was dropped down, created the 28%. Then in 2005, we also did the amendments. And so you see that this has continued to work down. And quite frankly, the higher our sales go, the lower this number becomes. And you can see that that dynamic is in place. And if it were not for the economy and the smoking ban impacting our sales negatively, I am confident that in 2009 and 2010, you would have seen a 22% number here. So the difficulty was in 2009, the smoking ban began 6 months of that year, plus the economy was impacting us. And so you see that that rate actually increased a little bit. That's because our sales had dropped. And so the challenge here, again, the overall challenge, is to increase sales. Now, the reason I believe 22% is very important in that structure of this present contract that we have in place is that when you look to other states and when you look to other jurisdictions, and specifically jurisdictions that have the same business model, what you will see is there are some different commission rates in a video system. But really the standard is in the 21 to 22%. There is one location that has a 15%, and that's an issue that gets debated, and the Commission has heard a lot of testimony about that. But I will say the majority of those jurisdictions with a similar business model are in the 21 to 22%. So you see that the effort before was to get us close to the world standard or North American standard, and I believe we were well on the way to accomplishing that. There is discussion that comes out in the media about what is the average commission to a retailer. And so I've given you this next chart. Because the if you divide all of the sales by the total number of retailers, you come up with something around $75,000. But what is important to keep in mind is everyone, their access to population, the ability to increase sales is different statewide. And we are a statewide organization. We're mandated to be statewide, and we want to be statewide. We don't want to be the Portland Lottery or the I-5 Lottery. We want to be the Oregon Lottery. And so you see that almost half of our retailers actually make $24,000 or less a year in commissions. There's about a third that make in that figure that you'll see published, and they average $78,000. And then there's 20%, the top 20% of all sellers, that make in excess of $150,000 in commissions in a year. Then the last thing that I'll note, because this is something that comes into the debate as well, is that The purpose of the lottery is to produce funds for public programs from the state of Oregon. And divided among four different programs, economic development about 18%, education about 18%, parks and watershed enhancement 7.5% each. But there is a portion about almost half or in excess of 45% that the legislature is able to direct that extra money to one of those four. And the legislature has chosen in the past 10 years to always give that extra amount to education. So what ends up happening is education receives about two-thirds of all lottery dollars, and then 18% economic development, 7.5, 7.5. And so the debate that you'll hear a little bit today and that the commission continues to hear tends to focus on we need to increase lottery dollars so that we can provide more money for education. And so I wanted to give a little bit of history on that to you, and that's on the back side of this page. And as I came before the Revenue Committee in the spring of 2005, it was near the end of the 2003-05 biennium. And really at that time, we were projected to produce somewhere closer to $490 million for education. We were able to get line games up and going before the end of that biennium, and actually $537 million was provided to education in that biennium. The next biennium, we were able to increase that by almost $130 million, up into $660-some million. And at the end of this last biennium, we were able to produce all the dollars that were budgeted. Even though we had challenges from the economy, we produced all those dollars, and $967 million were allocated to education in last biennium. And so in that four-year period of time, you saw a $430 million increase to education funding just from lottery dollars. And so we're very proud of that fact, and something that needs to remain in the discussion and the debate is that retailer network, and the strength of that network is what produces these dollars to allow us to increase and maximize revenues and profits. The last thing I'll just say is that our legal process is that we have had public hearing, we have had invited testimony at the commission meetings, and we have a process where we had about 2.5 months to allow for public comment on this precise issue. That period of time is open until October 19th. After that time, then it is my task to review all of that input and to make a recommendation to the commission. And on October 30th, which is the next monthly commission meeting, they will have the ability then to discuss that in a public meeting, and if they choose to, at that point, adopt a commission schedule, which would then become a contract, which we would then begin the process of printing, signing, presenting to about 3,500 retailers, 2,400 of which are video retailers, and get that signed and in place. So that's the process, a little bit of information. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. This has always been perplexing to me, and I will be asking the same question of Mr. Perry, but you have, from your perspective, the retailers have these machines in their taverns or bars, and their customers come in and they use the machines. And so they get, a substantial amount of money every year for whether it's in the $25,000 category or the $150,000 category. Mm-hmm. That's still money in addition to what they normally make by just selling, beer and wine and things to eat. So what do they actually do You called them the marketers. What do they actually do, and do they have any kind of accounting of their spending that they give to the lottery?
Well, Chair Burdick, this is a matter of intense debate in the public hearings, as you know. And certainly over the years, I believe this has changed. And when video lottery began, when I mentioned that the rate was 35%, and in effect, jurisdictions who initiated video lottery, whether in Canada or in the United States, there was a significant gray machine market in place. And in Oregon, that was true. And those were machines that were owned by retailers, and their customers were utilizing these machines. Now, they looked like slot machines, but they were not supposed to be gambling devices. They were amusement only. And yet, this was something already there. They were able to obtain the income from those machines, just like they do on pool tables or video games or anything else. And that was taken away from them. Because if it no longer were gray machines allowed, they were illegal gambling devices, and if you were going to have a machine for video poker, it had to be an Oregon lottery machine. And so there was that trade-off that took place. Now, from that point forward, there has been changes. Now, the criticism that comes forward is that, well, they aren't doing anything. You know, they pay for electricity of these machines sitting over in the side. And I must say that I talk with retailers all the time, and I'll tell them, if that's your business model, you aren't going to have machines very long, and you aren't going to stay in business. Because someone who makes $80,000 a year or $150,000 a year in commissions, they assign staff to deal with those customers. They may provide coffee, soft drinks, food as items to encourage them to come into their place. Just as stores offer sales on steak or hamburger or whatever, they would do the same thing. And they have to have a business plan to do this. We see their business plans when they open up. I know that presently, if you want to have a high customer count or lease space somewhere where there is a high traffic count, which would be important for sales, they're going to have to sign a 5-year lease to do that. They will probably have to give a percentage of their sales to the landlord to do that, because landlords are very much quickly tied into the idea that video lottery can produce income. They have to have security, again, if their players are going to feel safe. And so I've seen where retailers will spend thousands of dollars on video cameras. I've seen where one retailer, $10,000 is given as an appropriate amount for expenses. I see where retailers will spend $10,000 just on a safe to help protect their employees and not have a lot of cash on hand at any given time. So there are a lot of expenses that are entailed, but I think the business plan is you must treat this as a customer that you want to feel happy about your business, who want to come back, that feels appreciated, and that takes time, effort, and ultimately money. But there becomes this discussion is what's too much, what's just a business choice, what should the lottery examine? But I do know the successful retailers treat people as individuals, and they like that establishment, and they want to come back.
Because kind of devil's advocate, if you have a, you know, somebody who's making, you know, $150,000 at their establishment, and you reduce the commissions to the point where they only make $100,000, you know, why would they give up the machines? Because that's what's said. I mean, why would you give up $100,000 in revenue?
Well, Chair Burdick, every one of these is an individual kind of business decision that comes forward. And so, for instance, if I have seen a business plan for an individual that probably would expect to get into this 150 range in commissions, But I know they have to sign a five-year lease to do that, and a very expensive lease. And I know that they will expend close to $150,000 to construct and modify this business and open it up. Now, whether or not that's a wise decision, I can't say. But just the idea that we just set these machines over in the side, they are not going to be successful. Now, 15 years ago, maybe they were, because they were unique. They were brand new. There were no casinos in Oregon. But today, with all of the competition you have from a wide variety of legal and illegal gambling, besides all other entertainment, if that's all you do is set them over there, you will not make money, and we won't make money, and eventually I'm going to pull those machines out of that location.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dale, do you have any statistics or any data that looks at the overhead costs that are allocated to the machine, such as a parking space that's provided, the facilities, the utilities, the rent, the property taxes, all the operating expenses of the establishment that would be allocated to the machines, meaning they could have something else there. But those machines do more than just plug in. They do absorb costs in addition to the promotion and marketing that you're also talking about. Do you have any statistics and data on that?
Madam Chair and Senator Telfer, this is unique to every single retailer, unfortunately. And so we have some generalities, and we do examine business plans, mm-hmm. and there are some choices that come into play. But every retailer, if they have a restaurant business and they're going to put in video, they're going to have to make a decision, I'm going to give up four tables. How much money do I make in those tables with my food business for me to give that space? But then there are other costs. And so, unfortunately, it's very difficult without doing an individualized audit of every retailer, and that gets into other issues. But I only have generalities in that area.
Follow up. Thank you. Well, I do know that we have national averages and we have state averages that say in a restaurant doing this level of sales, this would be the average labor costs, direct costs, overhead costs, et cetera. So those figures do exist. I don't know why we can't do that also for actually some of these different levels of, I mean, you have the data, I would imagine. So mm-hmm. it would be interesting to see what the true cost of housing that machine and operating that machine and promoting that machine costs, because there are other costs other than just plugging it in, obviously.
Right.
So, which also then drives the percentage of the revenue coming back to cover those costs. I think that needs to be looked at before you can just say that, you know, 22% is a fair reimbursement for the use of all the operating costs that that owner incurs.
Well, Chair Burdick and Senator Telfer, we certainly have individualized retailers that have shared individual costs in that way. It is difficult to take in a statewide organization and say costs for leases in Portland are this, a cost in Burns, Oregon is this. You can make some general decisions or judgments in that, but it is very difficult to then design a statewide program, because I heard the term before, and this comes up in the media all the time, that this is a negotiation of a contract. This is not a negotiation. This is a public administrative rulemaking process, and so it has 2.5 months of public comment. It isn't a sit down with two people and negotiate a contract. It's to try to bring in all of these different viewpoints and yet make it fair, make it so it operates, make it so it produces that $1 billion and maximizes revenue. So, but that attempt is made, and we do get individualized views, but they tend to be focused on just that one retailer in that location.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you.
We'll start off with Mr. Perry. Did you have a retailer you wanted to bring with you, Bill?
I didn't know how much time, so I didn't know who wanted to bring anybody.
There'll be a prize for brevity.
So. Oh.
On all sides.
Yes. For the record, Bill Parrott, the Oregon Restaurant Association. I want to thank Chair Burdick and members of the committee for my opportunity to speak here. And what I've got here is the testimony I turned in at the last presentation we gave in front of the lottery. But actually, if I can back up to the fourth page, if you look, the third page outlines the history of the rate negotiation, and I'll kind of come back to it. But I also then have the lottery's printouts of their sales figures. And as you look at it, this is this year's sales figures, and they're already about $17 million off their original projection because sales continue to decline even after July of this year. And I'll get into why I believe that is true. And if you go in the previous or the next page, which would be the previous year, you see they missed their projections almost every week as they did sales. And as you follow it down, obviously, you get into the weeks of 10-18. You see kind of bigger jumps in there. That's really where the economy hit our industry. Then you look at December, where you had two $4 million weeks. If you remember, those are the weather weeks where people didn't go out in the snow. And then following that, you had the smoking ban where you start to decline into $14 million weeks. And even in the next page, which was the previous year before that, you had your record sales year of $895 million. But when you look at the last 2 months of that year, you started missing projections, meaning sales started flattening out as of a year ago, June. So before the economy, before the smoking ban, you really saw a change in the rates or the way that the lottery is making money. And now, if you go back to the history of the compensation rate, I'll tell you why I believe that happened. I'm going to talk in a minute about what I call a dead zone in the current rate structure because you got a two-option system. Back in July of 2004, they changed to a two-option system, meaning if you're a low-volume retailer, if you do less than $675,000 in gross sales, you're better off choosing option A under this scenario. Okay. If you do more than $675,000 in sales, you're better off in option B under this system. That's just the simple math if you look at it.
Bill, what are you referring to as sales? Is that lottery sales? Or
just all dollars.
All dollars.
You know, my share, lottery share, your share. That's all sales.
But all sales of food, beverage?
No, just lottery. This is just lottery sales.
Okay.
Okay, so if your net receipts of lottery are $675, your better option B and option A. So then when you look at this in option A, at $475, you get almost a 40% reduction in your sales in my dollars in my business. So going from 26% to 17%, it's actually 36%, but as you get down to the bottom, it's 40%. And so once you pass $475, you have this zone where at between $675 and $475, you've got what I would call step on the gas. It's not cost effective to sit in that zone because that is basically intended to be a punitive rate to drive you into option B. So they're trying to make that last rate so punitive it forces you into choosing option B. Now, when they did this in 2004 is, if you remember those of you that are in the legislature, they added a sixth machine for high-end retailers. So I had a choice as a retailer. I can rev up, step on the gas, get a sixth machine, and then I can reach $675. Then when you look at July of 2005, when they reduced the rate again, that's when they added line games. Once again, an incentive for me to make more money, so I making that $200,000 jump was a little bit easier to do because I had an opportunity to increase my revenue and make that jump from $475 to $675. Now, you fast forward today where you've had basically declines in sales, smoking ban, everything else. You have people now dropping below that $675 figure. And so what you have right now is retailers switching from option A or option B into option A and basically putting on the brakes, basically saying it does them no good to do sales over $475. So you're not seeing a reduction in retailers. You're seeing a reduction in retailer hours because it's no longer cost effective to stay open after my main meal hours. And so if you go back to the second sheet on my testimony, go down to the graph there, it shows you Option B retailers. In the year 2008, there were 347, and actually 360 of them made it over that level. So there's basically 13 that made what I would say is the wrong decision. They should have chose Option B because they lost money. Now, just very few of them. In 2009, you had 384 that then chose it. But that's when the smoking ban hit. So you only had 255 that actually made that level. So what you saw of the gap in between there of those retailers, a bunch of them said, I'm putting on the brakes. So you only had 320 choose Option B. The other ones kind of put on the brakes and said, I'm going to operate at lower hours and a higher commission rate. Remember, my rate of return is now increasing and my operational hours are decreasing. So the retailer is actually better off in this scenario. As you look at sales that have dropped since July, as of right now, under current sales figures, 160 of those 320 have chosen wrong. So if you don't change the system, if you just said, we're going to keep the system the way it is, come next July, I think you're going to see 100 retailers potentially choose that I'm going to go back to Option A and put the brakes on. So I would say in your fiscal year 2011, you have a chance at another $50 million loss in lottery sales from where you're at today. And so I think, just personally, if you look at it, you could not change the blended rate and fix the system, meaning why make a retailer make a choice of that $200,000 dead zone? If your intention, not yours, but if the lottery's intention is to basically force people into Option B once they cross 475, just take out that 14% tier and put Option B in the bottom so they no longer have a choice. So basically go 23, 22, and then 17.5. I mean, it eliminates the choice, it eliminates the dead zone, and then as sales drop or decline or do whatever, it doesn't put the retailer in that choice where they have to make a decision to put the brakes on. And I think to answer the chair's earlier question on are people going to remove the machines, you have more retailers than you did 3 years ago. And I would say the lottery system as it's set up is making less money. So having more retailers and generating less revenue makes me less money, makes you less money, and makes the lottery less money. You're losing your sales in your high-volume retailers. And unfortunately, like almost everything else, as Chair Penn Director Penn described, 80% of your sales is coming from 20% of retailers. And anything you do that basically get them to put on the brakes, almost all your lost sales are coming from that, basically just simple structural changes in their business. And so, yeah, you can lower their commissions, you can lose hours, you will probably still have a lottery system as it works, but it's going to be a lot smaller than your lottery system is today, just because they are not driving to generate revenue in non, basically, I would say, high food sales hours. As a projection for next year, I think you have a possibility of losing another $50 million next year if the system isn't changed. I think a fundamental change has to happen to try to restore that what I would call dead zone. And so with that, I don't know if that was brevity enough. It was a lot of information in a short period of time.
Well done. When they decide to go into the Option B, what kinds of things do they do to build sales? I mean, I'm very aware of the lottery ads that occur on TV, but I've never had my local tavern, I've never seen any outreach by my local tavern
Chair Burdick and members of the committee. And like I said, what you're talking about is the structure of that business. And okay, a tavern is different than a breakfast place. Lottery is not your local tavern. Lottery is in basically every aspect of the restaurant business. And to give you a few examples that might be clear, the way they change their operational things, some are attracting these customers and some aren't. I mean, you can go during a tavern or a breakfast place or anybody and find different things that they do. But what you found under the scenario was those taverns then all of a sudden decided they wanted to stay open for breakfast. And there was enough revenue from lottery and enough revenue from meals that as you put two together, it was worth it to be open for breakfast. So they stayed open outside their traditional hours, which for a tavern is 12 to 12. Now you take a breakfast place like Elmer's. They used to close before lottery at 9 o'clock. Anybody that's ever frequented Elmer's, they moved it up to 10 and then to midnight. Now they're bumping it down basically back to 10 and to 9 because they're not doing a lot of food sales in there, but when you combine the rate of return with the food sales, it gave them an ability to stay open those 2 hours. Now, they lost 3 hours a day, which is 21 hours a week, and the state is getting 75, 73, 77 cents on the dollar of every hour you're open. I'm only getting basically 23 cents on the dollar. So it's an easier decision for me to make to close those 3 hours where ultimately the loser is the state because my operational costs have declined. And so the rate of return is basically really truly going to be based on what your operational costs are. Elmer's is not going to close during breakfast. They're not going to. They may leave the machines there. You'll still have a lottery that generates you money. But if your intention is to maximize revenue, you want those guys to go out and capture customers outside their meals hours. I mean, it's just the way the system is working today. They're just closing hours. They're not closing units. There are some units closing, but most of your lost sales are coming in hours that operate outside of my main meal or customer hours, and that's how you maximize revenue in the state.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Bill. And now we'll have Steve Novick and Dana Hepper.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Advocacy Director with Stand for Children, and I just want to first say thanks to the committee for taking the time to learn about this issue. I know that there's no impending decision that you all have to make about this, but if this body ever does decide we want to revamp the Constitution or the ORS around this issue, you all would be the ones that need to be in the know. So I'll work to be really brief. I've submitted to you the testimony I presented to the Lottery Commission last Friday. And I just wanted to walk through some of the documents you've received today and respond to those with some of the information that was in that testimony I submitted. First, on this retailer compensation graph where you see the curve graph versus the straight line graph, really the debate that's going on here, I think we both agree if the compensation rates were zero, the lottery would not make money because tavern owners would not put them in their establishments. The debate is really about where this peak point is. Is it farther to the left here or farther to the right? And that's the debate we're trying to figure out the answer to. And fortunately, we do have some information that helps us figure out where that peak point should be. There have been three major studies conducted about the lottery by economist Joe Courtwright, by the Secretary of State's office who did an audit, and by Eco Northwest. And all three studies, I won't go into the details, but the headline is, we're paying the retailers too much. They would keep the machines for less money, and the state could get more money. Director Penn has been really great throughout this whole process, getting us all the information that we need. And I just want to make the point that while everywhere else might be also paying their retailers too much, doesn't mean that Oregon should. On the fiscal year 2009 breakdown, that chart that Commissioner Penn, or that Director Penn gave you with the number of retailers in different categories, just want to highlight here that this really indicates that lottery retailers with very low sales are continuing to keep the machines in their establishments. So obviously they still find that to be a worthwhile item to have in their business. And in fact, we don't need to continue to increase the number of retailers. Our interpretation of this information is that we've essentially saturated the market. We know how many Oregonians are going to play video lottery. We know how much they're going to spend at this point. It's been in place for a few years. We understand what the market is. We don't need more machines. If I ate dinner at Elmer's and want to go play video poker, I'm going to go next door and find a video poker machine. And the last point I wanted to make, and then I'll turn it over to Steve, is this chart about proceeds for education. And certainly the lottery has become an important component of funding public schools in Oregon. And while the lottery proceeds have been increasing here, we all know that property tax proceeds have been decreasing, and that means the general fund, primarily funded by income tax, has been increasingly squeezed. So while lottery proceeds are increasing, we're still only funding about 80% of the quality education model. It doesn't mean we're, you know, lottery proceeds are increasing, therefore we have enough money for schools, therefore we should continue to give retailers too much money. On Senator Telfer's question, we do, the Eco Northwest study addressed the question of how much does it cost to keep the machines in play, and they estimated, you know, they took into account some are rural, some are urban, they estimated somewhere between $6,700 and $8,800 annually to house video lottery in a retailer establishment. Stanford Children's crafted a proposal that's on the fourth page of the testimony I received to you for the Lottery Commission's consideration. And with that, I will close my testimony.
Thank you very much. Steve, let's take you and then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. Senator Burdick, members of the committee, thanks for inviting us here today. I am here to urge the committee.
Your name?
I'm Steve Novick. Madam Chair, I apologize. My name is Steve Novick, and I have been periodically examining this issue of video poker commissions over the past 10 years. And I am here to urge the members of the committee to have some conversations with Director Penn and the members of the Lottery Commission to urge them to, over time, reduce the commissions and to beg them not to sign another six-year contract at the current rates, which is what, I mean, what one of the problems I think the lottery has had over the past 15 years, they sign very long-term contracts, which prevent them from doing the kind of market experimentation that a normal business does. Senator Telfer asked if the lottery has made an effort to find actual data on what costs are attributable to having these machines. And in fact, the studies that Ms. Hepper described do exactly that. In 1994, both the Secretary of State in an audit and economist Joe Courtwright, who then worked for the legislature, went out and they visited a number of video poker taverns. And they watched how much labor is dedicated to attending to video poker players. They tried to determine what the capital costs were of having the machines there. And both of them concluded that when you look at that, the costs weren't that great, that it doesn't take much time for staff to deal with video poker players. Every once in a while, a gambler will win and print out a winning slip and come out to have it redeemed. And every once in a while, the tavern owner has to take money out of the machine and put it in the bank. But there is not much labor cost involved. And what both the Secretary of State and Mr. Courtwright concluded was that if you gave the taverns 10% of the take, they would make at least as good a profit as they make on their basic business of being a tavern or restaurant. The Lottery Commission in 1994 simply ignored those studies. In 1998, there was another study by KPMG Pete Marwick that surveyed retailers and asked them what their costs were. And they noted that many of the retailers made exactly the kind of claims that Director Penn just referenced, that it cost a lot for security, that it cost a lot for insurance, this, that, or the other. But they also noted that very few retailers were able to come forward with actual admissible evidence, real evidence of those claims. The KPMG study concluded that the average tavern was making a 100 to 300% profit. The typical tavern in the restaurant industry, the profit in the restaurant industry is about 15%. The lottery effectively ignored that study as well. In 2004, the lottery itself commissioned a study by Eco Northwest, and the economist went out, visited a number of establishments, and concluded that pretty much any video poker outlet that made $10,000 a year was going to make a reasonable profit. The lottery effectively decided to ignore that study as well. I submit that a normal business does not behave this way. A normal business doesn't see numerous studies saying it's overpaying one of its group of its contractors and keep on paying them what in this case is on average $70,000 a year. A normal business doesn't say, well, our economist says that we should pay them $10,000 a year, but we're paying them $70,000 a year. We're going to keep on doing that. I agree, actually, with something that Mr. Perry said. Mr. Perry suggested that it doesn't make sense to have widely different compensation schemes for high-volume retailers and low-volume retailers. The compensation scheme now says that the best performers get the lowest rates. I don't actually see the necessity for that. That appears to be based on the idea that that the lottery's goal is to have a large number of retailers as opposed to maximize the amount of money that brings in. General Motors, as you may have noted in reading the paper over the last few months, recently had to come to the conclusion that there was something wrong with the fact that it had far many more dealers per customer than Toyota did. It had excessive dealer overhead, and they are closing down a bunch of dealerships, recognizing that they could reach the same customer base with a lot fewer dealers. The contrast between Alberta, Canada's video lottery system and ours shows the same logic at work. Alberta, Canada has a 15% commission rate, a flat commission rate. And even an economist the Restaurant Association recently hired to look at the issue of commission rates acknowledged that the amount of money that gamblers lose in video poker machines in Alberta is the same percentage of total personal income in Alberta as the amount of money that gamblers lose in Oregon's video poker machines is a percentage of personal income in Oregon. And Mr. Jager, the economist, acknowledged that if you look at the history of video poker revenues in Oregon, it was almost totally tied to the amount of total personal income in the state. The only inference to draw from that is there's a certain number of people in the state who are going to gamble a certain amount, and as long as there are several thousand machines scattered across the state, they're going to find enough machines to gamble in. And it doesn't matter if you've got 1,500 retailers or 2,300 or 15% or 22%, the gamblers are going to find the machines. And the state's obligation is to make money for the state, not to support any certain number of retailers, not to comply with the expectations of retailers based on their historic provision of line games in the 1980s, I mean of gray games in the 1980s. So I submit that it would be worthwhile for all of you to have a conversation with the lottery and ask them, why are you basing your decisions on anecdotal claims by tavern owners and by this, the idea that we need to go out of our way to maintain a certain number of retailers, than on raw business logic, that when you look at the studies, you could pay them a lot less and the retailers would still be making money, and if they're making money, they're going to keep the machines. This decision should be based on the observation that in the past couple of years, with the decline in the economy and the smoking ban, the amount of money that people are gambling has gone down, but the number of retailers has stayed the same. Well, if you can cut their effective commissions by reducing the amount of gambling and they still keep the machines, if you simply cut their commission rates, they would have kept the machines too. But especially, I would urge you to urge the lottery not to simply lock in the current rates for another 6 years. I mean, normal businesses don't decide to pay people the same amount for six-year periods. They make room for a period. I mean, if they cut their pay to somebody and the person keeps on selling them the stuff, then they cut their pay again until they stop selling them the stuff. That's the way a normal business behaves. And I submit that it is time the lottery started behaving more like a normal business. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. Questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you. And thank you for your testimony. Kind of the dilemma that occurs to me that we have, and this has come from my district, from people that have establishments and they have licenses, is that there are a number of establishments that if you take the lottery away, the business fails. So there's a dependency factor on the lottery in the overall scheme of costs, revenue and costs, that keeps that business open. And I guess the dilemma is, you know, are we in the business of closing business? And these are, a lot of them are small proprietorships. And if you bring the lottery commission down to the rate you're proposing, what I heard from people in my district is that many of these establishments, in fact, would close. So So that may be the hard, tough love of an economic model, but when you factor kind of the social, economic issue,
Chair Burdick,
problematic.
Yeah. Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, I think that's a great question and the hard reality of Oregon Lottery. And fortunately, it's not a dilemma of the Lottery Commission because they have a very clear statutory mandate to maximize revenue to the state, and that revenue is to pay for schools, economic development, and the state revenue is to pay for schools, economic development, and parks, salmon, wildlife. And so they have a very clear mandate, not as an organization established to help create a profit for unprofitable businesses, but a clear mandate to bring revenue to the state. So I think for the Lottery Commission, the choice is clear. We're sorry if this is the thing keeping your doors open. That's not the job of the lottery. At the same time, given that that's the reality, what we've proposed is a phase-in of a lower rate that does nothing between 2010 and 2011, because we know some businesses have been hurt particularly hard by the recession and the smoking ban. And so we've proposed doing nothing until the biggest effects of those two factors begin to wear off, and then implement a gradual phase-in so that businesses have the time to adjust their business plan to make sure that they're making wise business decisions based on a new reality of the Oregon Lottery more closely meeting its legal mandate.
Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, if I may add to that, one point to consider is that the Oregon Constitution prohibits casinos, and the Oregon Supreme Court has said that an establishment whose primary use or primary purpose is gambling is a casino and therefore illegal. And I would submit that if an establishment only survives because of video poker, then it meets that definition of casino. And I would also submit, as Ms. Hepper did, that it is not the lottery's job to keep all the businesses that it works with open any more than it is General Motors' job to keep as many dealerships open as possible. The citizens of Oregon are the shareholders of the lottery, and the citizens of Oregon have a right to expect the lottery to generate the most money possible for public purposes, largely education, parks and salmon, and economic development, just as the shareholders of General Motors have a right to expect that company to generate revenue for them rather than to keep a certain number of dealerships in business.
Other questions? Oh, thank you very much.
I do have
Senator
one.
Senator Telford.
Where do I begin? It's true that the lottery is to maximize the dollars that can be used to support state services, education being maybe the prime one at this point. But it's not a build it and they'll come. They need to partner with those establishments. I mean, there's got to be some incentive for an establishment to actually do the marketing and generate those sales and cover their costs to do it. Otherwise, it isn't going to get done. So is there not a sweet spot here that says, okay, we're going to partner with these establishments that are going to do our work? They're going to do the marketing. They're going to maintain those machines. They're going to let people park in their lots and come into their establishment. Where's the sweet spot? I'm not hearing from you any support for the actual person or the business or the entity that's actually doing the work on the machine and
Thanks.
Getting the sales in.
Thanks so much, Senator Telfer, for that question, Chair Burdick. No, I think we absolutely agree with you 100% that this is a partnership and that we're dependent upon restaurant owners to dedicate a portion of their establishment to housing these machines. The Lottery Commission does the upkeep of the machines, so they're not responsible for that piece. And that's why we've proposed a structure that gives retailers a higher percentage for the first $50,000 in revenue in net receipts that come in through the lottery to recoup a reasonable amount of cost that helps cover all of those things like the phone lines, the electricity, you know, the cleaning supplies for spraying off the dust from the top of the machine, et cetera, all the things outlined in the Eco Northwest study as costs associated with that area. Now, there's no evidence, or there's actually evidence against the fact that there are additional staff costs because you have video lottery in your establishment. In fact, the smallest establishments often have staff that has some downtime that then just ends up using a small portion of that downtime to do the things associated with lottery, where it wouldn't be like they could cut back staff if they didn't have lottery. They'd basically just have staff not doing something during that short period of time. That's what the Eco Northwest study indicates, which is our only official look and insight into those costs. So we've said keep a higher percentage until you've recouped annual costs, and after that, when the dollars coming in are significantly profit, then have a lower rate on those costs. But certainly we're not suggesting, you know, go down to 0% or 1% or 5% rate. We're just suggesting utilize the information in the three studies that have been done on this topic, the three independent studies that say a $10,000 a year would be adequate profit, one of them says, and 10% lottery rate, retailer rate, would be adequate profit, the other two studies say. So we're actually suggesting something higher than any of those three studies indicate, which I think is a fair partnership.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I just want to echo what Ms. Hepper said. Those studies were, in fact, attempts to find the sweet spot. What both Mr. Courtwright and the Secretary of State did in 1994 was try to see how much would you have to give the taverns for them to still make as much profit off video poker as they would off their normal restaurant business. And both of them concluded that if they got 10% of the proceeds, they would make at least as big a profit as a normal profitable restaurant does off its business. And Mr. Whalen in 2004 made the same effort. He said that any tavern owner that's making $10,000 a year is going to be making at least as big a profit as they would on their normal restaurant business. And also, on the subject of marketing, the taverns aren't really allowed to advertise the fact that they have video poker. People know it, but they can't take out ads on TV saying, we have video poker. And economist Michael Kennedy, who works for the state, I believe he works for the Office of Economic Analysis in the past, has said that he doesn't think that retailers have much control at all over how much people gamble in their establishment unless they choose to pull out the machines altogether. He once said, somewhat sarcastically, I have seen no evidence that any retailers hire massage therapists to keep the gamblers happy so that they gamble more.
That's a good note to end on. Thank you very much. Okay. Our final item today is a very important one. Well, first, before we go to that committee, I just wanted to present this briefing today because we don't know. Occasionally in the past, this issue has kind of percolated up to the legislative level. We've had the lottery in effect since 1980. Video games since Mazin 1986, I think, 87. So I just wanted the committee to be informed about where we are and some of the issues involved in case we become a player on the issue in February or in 2011. So our next item is Measure 50, another low-level, low-profile, non-controversial issue.
On to another mundane matter.
It's been an entertaining day.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as you recall, Measure 50 project is something you discussed in terms of your work plan for really more in terms of something to keep us occupied throughout the interim, rather than necessarily a February issue. But we've started this a project just preliminarily, and frankly, I've been a little bit obsessed with that research report and didn't follow up on some things. But we did have a meeting a week and a half ago. And I just summarized kind of what we're proposing in terms of the outline for you, and it should be in your packet under Measure 50 Project Proposed Outline. You can find it in there. So And basically what we have done is under stage one, we're suggesting that the key element is try to assess the degree of horizontal and vertical inequities in the system. You had largely what we're trying to do is build on a hearing that the committee had in the last interim in Tigard, and we had kind of went back to Measure 50 and talked about how some of the origins of it, and you had some pretty strong testimony from individual taxpayers who were had assessment ratios that were out of whack with their neighborhood, and they were the ones, of course, who ended up with a much higher tax burden. So really that's the genesis of this, to try to look at the degree in which we see those horizontal inequities and to see if we can tie them back. We've started our review process, and we really selected four counties to try to help us assess to the extent this is in play. And the counties are Deschutes County, Multnomah County, Jackson, and Sherman counties. And at our first meeting, we had Dan Ross, the assessor from Jackson County, on the phone, and we had Scott Langdon from Deschutes County, assessor, who's done a lot of work at this. Of course, Deschutes County is the county that's had the largest run-up in residential values, and now, and Scott has a good chart showing how that's turned down. And also Dick Stradley, who is the assessor for Sherman County, where you have, you know, over half the county is in specially assessed property. So we've got those assessors. And, of course, as you recall, Chair Wheeler came before the interim committee and talked about a lot of the work the Multnomah County has done. So we have Reese Scholes here, and Reese has been very involved in helping us trying to set up the study. And also Seth Reeser, who has talked to the committee on from the city of Gresham, now has migrated to the city of Portland. So uh-huh. He's also helping us, and he's done a lot of work on this.
Good.
So they're on our review team and helping us try to format how we're going to do this. Essentially, I've put together kind of a rough outline of what we're looking at. The if you think of it statistically, the key a dependent variable is the Measure 50 value over the Measure 5 value. The Measure 5 value representing market value, except in those cases where you have specially assessed property where we don't want to look at the variations caused by that. The amount of taxes paid by individual properties, whatever the overall tax rate is, and then to look at types of property, the classes of property, look at them by a neighborhood or code area to get that individual variation, and also to look at new transactions. The other aspect we're looking at in terms of trying to go forward when we've had kind of this almost really an evaluation of the problem to the extent it exists, and we can try to get a better handle on it and how much it varies within counties and across counties, and then to look at some potential solutions to set up some simulations that will allow us to look at some of the things you've talked about, some of the things the Revenue Restructuring Task Force has talked about and been proposed in some SJRs you had in the last session. So those are things I put down there. So Day is coordinating things from our end, and I think that some of the information that was shared at our review team meeting has been distributed to you, and we'll let our panel follow up from there.
Yeah, anybody in Portland, this will either make you very happy or make your blood boil. Comparison, we heard a lot of testimonies mm-hmm. before your time, Senator mm-hmm. Telfer, but we had a hearing in Tigard where much of the same information came out with people, just even with neighbors in their same neighborhood, or just vastly different tax rates for a variety of reasons. So who wants to start?
Oh, I guess I'm going to start. I'm Reese Scholes from Multnomah County Chair Ted Wheeler's office. Chair Burdick, Senators, on behalf of Chair Wheeler, let me say thank you for keeping hope alive on this issue, or in the words of the spiritual, keep on moving forward. This is the panel that has continued to look at this issue when I think others in our state have just sort of thrown up their hands and said, what the heck can we do? I'm very excited about the study that you have commissioned and that we're all part of. I just want to comment this morning, and I brought you the two handouts, and I want to talk about moving from anecdotal information to the systematic scientific collection of information. The shorter sheet that I gave you, A Tale of Two Blocks, this is classically anecdotal information, and it's stuff that should make your blood boil. In the left-hand column, you see that we're looking at 8 different houses in Multnomah County that all have a market value, a value determined by willing buyers and willing sellers, that's somewhere in the $300,000 range, and this handout is ordered in smallest to largest. But then you see that the assessed values are all over the map compared to how the real market values. And then you look over at the addresses and you find that there's a pattern, and that's the theme of this, two blocks, that the folks on Southwest 61st are paying on the average about $3,000 more per year for houses that are the same, that have the same market value. If somebody had just moved to Portland from Los Angeles and they're looking for houses, they look in one neighborhood and their taxes are $3,000 more a year for houses that they will pay essentially the same price for. It's outrageous. $250 per month. I just want to make one comment on yet another unintended consequence of this inequity. One of the problems that we have in Portland is gentrification of neighborhoods and what that means for low-income people who have lived for many years in a neighborhood and rising property values are driving them out. The inequity of Measure 50 is accelerating gentrification, because if I'm that person from California who's coming to look at houses to buy, I can afford the $300,000 house in Northeast Portland, but I can't afford the $300,000 house in Southwest Portland because my income might not be sufficient to cover that extra $250 a month in carrying costs. So the effect of this is to further exacerbate the problem, because then the seller in Northeast Portland can sell the house for even more because my monthly cost is less because of the tax differential. So what we're doing is taking what's already a problem, gentrification, and we're pouring gasoline on that fire. But this is anecdotal. I picked these two blocks because they show the contrast, but also because I'm sort of intrigued by how 61 and 16 are the opposite of each other in Southwest and Northeast. This is an amateur anecdotal look at a big problem. Turn your attention to the longer sheet. I did the short one. I didn't do the long one. Actual experts did the long one, and I want to talk about why it's more valuable and why the study that you're launching here is going to be more valuable, because this doesn't look at 8 houses. This looks at every house in Multnomah County, and it doesn't look at a house-to-house thing. It looks at the averages of neighborhoods. You see on the vertical axis there is the average neighborhood RMV. So where the average neighborhood market value is $1 million, I would call that a fairly well-to-do neighborhood, and where it's around $200,000, I'd call that a lower income neighborhood. And then you can see along the horizontal axis is what we might call the change property ratio, the AV-RMV ratio, or the Measure 50, Measure 5 value ratio. Different points you'll see, they're slightly different, but those are really very similar things, the percentage of your house value that you're actually paying taxes on. And what's intriguing is to look in the $200,000 houses, there are ones that have a very low ratio and a very high ratio. So one of the things that we need to look at as we study what's the impact of the current system, and that's what we're going to do first, is there a correlation? Are rich people more frequently the losers, or are poor people more frequently the losers? We have a system that creates winners and losers. What can we learn about the different patterns, both geographically, income-based, in terms of when the homes were sold? And this is an example of the information that we need. But if you look at the top of my long sheet, you'll see that it's that it includes only non-rural residential and only in class one. Our look at this has been very, very narrow in Multnomah County and just about our own county. Now we're going to first look at four counties, and later on I hope we'll be looking at the whole state. We'll get a more comprehensive view, and because all of those different things drive what the CPR is, it has to be interconnected. The other thing that I want to say is I know that I'm sitting on a group with a lot of people with high level of technical expertise, and I think we're going to get some depth about the technical aspects of this problem. But I believe that we'll also try and do it in a way that we can help ordinary citizens, ordinary voters, the taxpayers who are behind the dots on here, understand what's really going on, because I think it's deeply misunderstood. And finally, let me say we're very close to when people are going to get their tax bills. And across Oregon, people are going to see on their tax bill that the market value of their property has gone down, but in many cases, their taxes have gone up. And we had an article in the newspaper about this just a few days ago, and I think that this is going to drive a whole bunch of people to say, by golly, we've got to do something to change this. And they're going to be very angry at a lot of people, including me and you, and we're going to hear from them. And I hope that we can use this as a moment for some widespread community education in Oregon, that people can understand that Measure 50, which a majority of voters voted for, has had consequences that are unintended. And this this fall is when we're going to see a lot of those unintended consequences come to bear.
Are you already getting people coming into the county? Are people already getting aware of this, or do you think it'll have to wait till they get their bills?
The phones are going to start ringing when they get their tax bill. And I don't like to put too much store by the comments that people post on newspaper websites. But there was a story in the Sunday Oregonian written by Jim Mayer, who fortunately actually understands this, and I thought explained it very well in that article. Yeah. And if you go to the Oregon Live website, you can get a preview of what we're going to be hearing, which is that that us, the government, really just raises people's taxes willy-nilly, and it doesn't matter what the law says or what the Constitution says. If we need money, we just go to the tax assessor and tell them to collect more. And I think that that's a widespread perception, and that putting some more information on the table may help a little with that.
I was interested in your comment that most people will see their taxes, or that many people will see their taxes increase. Based on this chart, I would say that most people will see their taxes increase by the 3%.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even people in very hard-hit areas.
Right. Yeah. And then there's a jurisdictional variation on what's passed. In Portland, we just passed a new children's levy, so the rate's going up as well as the 3%. So people will see, I think it's like something like a 5% increase, while many of them will see a 10% drop in value. So that's going to be shocking to people. You will hear from your constituents on this.
Yeah, no, I'll hear from myself. I live in Southwest, so
okay.
I'm part of the blood boiling crowd.
Madam Chair,
isn't this one of your
as
houses
Dr. Warner
here?
Said, Deschutes County got hit bad. Yes. We went through this last year. I mean, our values dropped so much, and the phones were ringing off the hook as to why am I paying more in taxes, and my house has gone, cut in half what its value was. So.
Well, it might be.
If you're looking for some guidance on it, call Scott. Yeah. Deschutes County's already gone through this,
and Deschutes County is going to be a big part of the work group.
Yeah.
So that'll be good. And I guess it's just the way I look at things. But when you have this type of situation, it might just be an opportunity to get people's attention and get them focused on some reasonable ways to fix this, because it really is a problem. Okay, Paul, should we move to Seth here?
Madam Chair, committee members, Seth Reeser from the City of Portland. Reese went into a lot of the details, gave a very good overview of some of the issues that you've directed the Legislative Revenue Office to study over the interim. And the focus has been mainly on the equity issue between taxpayers and how one person can end up paying three times as much in taxes as another person with a similar house and similar property values, and what the inherent inequities are in that. One of the other issues that came up as part of the revenue restructuring tax force, which I think we still need to keep in mind is the effects of the property tax system on how cities and counties grow and pay for growth. In Portland, we're very big on smart growth. What we've discovered on the finance side is that it's not very smart to encourage growth that you can't afford to provide basic services to based on how the property tax system is structured. So one of the things that we would encourage you to look at and encourage you to continue to assess is how new properties come on their tax rolls and how, with the mechanism that is mandated by the state constitution for that to happen. I realize that we're just starting out in the process and getting some cross-sectional data from a number of counties, but the analysis is that we've done up to this point over the time series from 1995 forward are showing some very interesting things, one of which is the gentrification issue, other is how people move and how that encourages growth within the housing markets and things like that. So once you guys have looked at the equity issue, we would advocate that you continue to look at some of the other issues that come out of the property tax system, because like Ms. Hepper said from the last panel, is that what you're seeing at the state level is that schools who are primarily reliant on property taxes to pay for their K through 12 education services are less and less able to meet that demand. So they have been coming to the state continually over the last few biennials and demanding more and more of the general fund share. So I think there's a number of different issues that are surround this and that are very complicated and are going to take some time to flesh out. But I want to thank you for directing Paul to convene the committee with the different county assessors and to begin taking a look at this comprehensively and statewide. And we support the committee and what the work that it's doing and are hoping that we get to some sort of resolution that allows us to modify this and address the inequity and growth issues that are inherent in Measure 50.
Thank you. And Seth, first of all, welcome to the city of Portland. We're glad to have you. But you did work at Gresham before, and it was on that basis that you testified at our Tigard hearing. And actually, Senator Rosenbaum, you were not present for that either. So we have two people who were not present for the Tigard meeting. And Gresham's testimony was very compelling, so I was wondering if you'd be willing to just say just a few things about the situation in the eastern part of the county, which is particularly extreme.
Yes, a lot of the work that Chair Burdick and committee members, a lot of the work that you see that we did out in Gresham, and the interesting case about Gresham is that Portland has a much larger revenue base and has more mechanisms to generate revenue for local government, whereas smaller cities have less options and less of a tax base and economic base to generate revenue to provide basic services. And one of the interesting things that we had seen since 1995 was before then, property taxes had been paying for our basic public safety services. If you look back all the way to 1940 out in East County, public safety services were covered by property tax, and that's essentially what they set the millage rate at, was whatever it took to cover the cost of providing the police and fire services out there. Since 1995, we'd seen the property tax revenue in East County and Gresham drop on a real dollar per capita basis from $400 per person to $280 per person, while the cost of providing that same service remained constant at $400 per person. So what we're seeing is that our main, within the city of Gresham, the main revenue source that local governments have to provide basic public safety services is not keeping pace with the cost of providing those services. And when we broke it down, the costs were increasing by the amount of population growth and the amount of inflation. So it wasn't that we were offering more services or trying to expand service coverage. It's that our main revenue source wasn't keeping pace with growth and inflation. And the analysis that we did was, when we looked at that, is that Measure 50 is set up so that existing properties that came on the tax rolls grew by 3% a year, which was enough to cover inflation over that time period. The problem that we were seeing was that the mechanism, the change property ratio that was set up so of how to account for new growth coming into the system, was not set up to capture that same amount of assessed value from those new properties. So what you were seeing was, as more and more properties were, as you were getting farther along from 1995 and more properties were coming on, you were seeing the ratio of how those properties were assessed drop. And I believe it started out in 1997 at 79%, and last year was at 51% for residential properties, and a similar drop for commercial properties. So what we were seeing was that as we were bringing more and more properties onto the tax rolls, we had less and less ability to provide public safety services, which make up 90% of the general fund out in the city of Gresham. So that's where that was the testimony that we covered at the last interim committee for the Revenue Restructuring Task Force.
It's kind of a complicated formula, but basically new construction, you know, for the, it has to come on at the percentage of market value as the general area. And so as that goes down, I think you had a pretty dramatic chart that over time, basically we're going to be paying them to come on. That's an overstatement, but basically they'll be paying very close to zero over a period of time.
Yes.
That doesn't pay for the services. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, this is a rhetorical question, but if the legislature was to enact a tax bill that taxed one property at $4,400, same value, another property at $1,500, what's the likelihood that the Supreme Court would find that action constitutional?
Senator Morris, Chair Burdick, recall that Measure 50 had to include language in the Constitution that authorized inequitable taxation.
It does. It's pathetic.
Because otherwise it would have had that problem. So it specifically acknowledges that it's not fair, and there it is.
Chair Burdick, Senator Morris, I think the appropriate analogy would be if you tried dropping a frog in a pot of boiling water, it'd jump out. But if you put it in before you heated it and turned up the heat slowly, it would boil alive. And I think that that's where we've gotten with the Measure 50 property tax system, is that these changes from year to year are very small, and they're very hard to see within, because we're dealing with very large numbers of properties, and we're dealing with things like Measure 5 real market value versus Measure 50 maximum assessed value. It's all kind of obscured by the number of different mechanisms that we have for tracking value and doing our assessment. But what people are starting to see, and what you guys are going to be starting to see, is that this is going to become a bigger and bigger problem for cities, counties, and schools to continue providing the basic level of services that our constituents are asking for out of this property tax system that is set up so that changing either the assessed value or the permanent rate is difficult or impossible.
Yeah, in many cases impossible. And to further answer your question, Senator Morris, there is a constitutional provision in the Oregon Constitution that similarly situated taxpayers have to be treated equally.
That was my question.
Yes, correct. And it was that provision that Measure 47 and Measure 50 specifically said did not apply to that other constitutional provision. And when you have a constitutional requirement and another constitutional amendment comes behind it, that exempts itself, then that generally takes precedence. Any lawyers want to dispute that? Senator Haas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At that hearing in Tigard, it's now notorious. It's like Gettysburg or something. none other than
which
Don.
Which side were we?
We're the good guys. Oh.
None other than Don McIntyre was there, and he was upset about this too, because this was not his deal, and he suggested just dumping the assessed value and at the same time rolling back the rate. Now, was that which didn't seem really unreasonable to me if it ends up being an overall wash, because it puts fairness and equity back in. Is that deemed too simplistic for the kinds of solutions that maybe this group is looking at, or is that maybe something close to that a realistic alternative?
I believe that that's one of the options that we'll look at. In the last session, you had Senate Joint Resolution 35, which tried to capture what was essentially Don McIntyre's proposal. I think that the folks who people who are fans of a shorter constitution would like this, because it would take out a whole lot of words that Measure 50 put in the Constitution in order to get around all the other requirements. The other thing that I would point out about this, we've talked about two kinds of problems: the inequity problem, and then the problem with funding local government service. But I mentioned the problem of people having their assessed value, their market value, go down and their tax bill go up. McIntyre's proposal is the only one that would actually simultaneously solve all three of those problems. It used to be, if we were currently operating under the old-fashioned Oregon system of property tax limitation, where the millage rate was set based on what you actually had to spend, you know, we'd be seeing people's tax rates go up, different things go on as a result of the recession. There was a letter to the editor about how that arguably Measure 50 protects local government because revenue keeps going up. What McIntyre is arguing for is for restoring the connection between taxation and market value. And what's happened to people's tax bills this year is a very strong argument for what he was saying, that maybe there should be something that would change when market values change, because we don't have that anymore.
And I would hope along those lines, and I've talked to Paul about this, I would hope that if you consider something like that, that you also factor into your analysis some kind of a transition process. For example, you know, if you went suddenly from the assessed value to the market value approach, you'd find some people that would be hit very severely. So to try to think of some kind of transition mechanism, for example, when a house changes hands to make the switch, or voluntarily, if a property owner voluntarily wants to make the switch, and in that way, you might be able to get there in the long run without the kind of personal disruptions that, among other things, might defeat a constitutional amendment. Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I recently spent 6 years as city councilor of probably one of the fastest growing areas of Oregon, and your comment about the growth, while I preached structural deficit for years, nobody really realized it was coming, because I think that growth hid the fact that the newer houses were paying less taxes because there was such a volume of money coming in. And so it was marginal, meaning, you know, the first 100 homes was enough cash to, you didn't have to hire another police officer. And so I don't think cities that were growing recognized that structural deficit until it stopped. So your comment about the growth, it was hidden for numerous communities that were growing, just didn't see it because the cash was flowing in, and, you know, you didn't have to hire another police officer until you had another 1,000 people move into the city. So, you know, I think that needs to be addressed too.
Madam Chair, Senator Telford, you're entirely correct, is that especially in a lot of rural counties, one of the answers to the budget question that came up each year was, well, if we add more properties to the city and we annex more properties, that'll bring in more revenue, which will make us better able to pay mm-hmm. for some of these basic services. And what and that worked each year until you started looking at the cumulative effect over the years of adding that growth at lower and lower change property ratio, as the change property ratio was declining, as those new properties were coming on at less, not paying as much as the existing properties did. All of a sudden you ran into the problem when you had to expand services to continue to provide police and fire services. All of a sudden people started to realize that the answer to our problem is not adding more houses and adding more properties to the city. The answer is going back and looking at the structure of how we in Oregon decide to pay for basic services from our schools, cities, and counties. So I think you're entirely correct that the problem was hidden, but it's not just hidden, but there was a belief that growth would actually solve the problem rather than growth being the problem.
Could one of you maybe, I'm sorry we don't have anybody from Deschutes County here, because I think they could.
I'm here.
Yeah, you're here. You can fill in. But maybe, Dave, you can get into this. There's a unique problem in some of the rural counties who started out with extraordinarily low tax bases. Yeah. And so if you could just summarize it, either you or Seth or probably Reese, that's probably not your area of expertise, but just kind of.
Chair Burdick. Committee members. The problems in Josephine and Jackson County, which is where I'm from originally, and I started out working in the city of Grants Pass, the problems that they had was that in 1997, when they set the permanent rates for a lot of these cities and counties, they were looking at what their revenue portfolio was at the time, and that was how their permanent rates were set, and they were locked into those permanent rates for a number of years. The problem with that is that in many of the rural counties of Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, and some of the counties in eastern Washington is that at the time the county's revenue base was more than half federal timber payments, and the property tax system assumed that that revenue basket was going to continue indefinitely. And as we know, as we can see now, those timber payments did not continue indefinitely, but the permanent rates that those counties were set up upon assumed that their revenue makeup was going to stay the same until the system changed. So that's where the problems that we start getting into with some of the rural counties is their permanent rates and the model is set up and essentially froze time in 1995. And the further away we get from that, the less and less the system makes sense.
And they basically have no option to increase their base. Is that correct? Or what is the requirement?
Madam Chair, they do have the local option. If they are if their market value is below, if their assessed value is below the Measure 5 value or market value, if they haven't used that option. And you recall the task force the governor put together, we got Gil back here too, who was played a big part in that. So they do have options to raise revenue temporarily, but they cannot change their permanent rates without a constitutional change. And that's where the inflexibility, I think, that Seth's talking about comes in, is those permanent rates, once they're set, there's virtually no flexibility for it to be changed.
And I assume that's part of the mission of the work group is to look at that issue as well and maybe consider a reset.
Well, you know, I would say, Madam Chair, that I think a big part of what the review team will do is to try to look at creating some flexibility within the system. I mean, there's kind of this macro flexibility if you're a county who's lost its timber payments, but there's also kind of this micro flexibility where we, as you recall, Mr. James coming in from Eagle Point, who was just totally baffled why he's paying, you know, $3,000 more on his property than his neighbor is. And we had all these explanations for him. He just kind of looked at it, well, that doesn't make sense. And so there's that kind of flexibility too.
Senator Hess.
Thank you. Quickly, do we have, is the same problem with commercial properties? The same dynamic? Worse, better?
Chair Burdick, Senator Haas, yes, it's the same for commercial properties. They're calculated separately, and each county calculates the change property ratio by property class, but the two that are very similar because of how their real market value and assessed value behave are residential and commercial. There's other issues with how industrial property and special assessment property, especially in Sherman County, is assessed, which are farms and utilities and what makes up a larger part of their land mass. But for rural or for more suburban and urban counties, the large, I think in Gresham, residential and commercial properties made up 92% to 93% of our tax base. The answer to the question is yes, we're experiencing the same problem with commercial properties as residential, and then there are other issues which the Legislative Revenue Office has brought up that relate to special assessments and industrial properties.
I'll just tell you anecdotally that I've looked at the difference between what a tavern close to Northeast 16th is paying in property taxes and a tavern close to Southwest 61st. And it's slightly less dramatic than the houses, but it's in exactly the same directions.
Wondered why I have to pay more for a hamburger in Hillsdale.
And Chair, does that affect the retailer compensation?
Exactly. Senator Telford, did you have another question?
Nope.
Okay. All right. Well, this has been great. Keep on keeping on, and I know that you've spread around statewide in terms of your the people that you're drawing upon. Paul, did you have any closing comments?
No. The only thing I have is if you wanted to say something on the bill.
In this topic.
No, Madam Chair, we'll continue to meet with a review team, and then what we'll try to do is update the committee as we go along. If there are things you think we're leaving out or you'd like us to focus on, just let us know, because we're still at that preliminary stage. I think the real positive for us is we've got some counties who have really thought about this and have built some good data for us to start from. So we're definitely not starting from scratch. And that's good. There was definitely a selectivity bias in the counties we chose, because we knew that they're interested in this issue and done a lot of work on it already.
Well, and I want you to relay to Chair Wheeler our continuing appreciation of the leadership that he and Multnomah County have taken on it. You guys have really stepped up and done some pretty hard work on this. So please say how much we appreciate it. And we hope we can get something, preferably before 2011. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And our last small item is potential bill drafts.
Distribute this.
We only get two for the committee, so.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
We can just pass them down.
Yeah.
There you go.
Brim.
So you want us to pick two or rank them or what?
Well, between I assume everyone on this committee has revenue as their number one issue. So I would like to see these issues brought up in the February session. That probably top priority is the SGR 29 or whatever it becomes on the rainy day fund. And then these others, we'll have probably the sunset extension for some tax credits set to expire in 2012. Remember our House Bill 2067?
Yes.
That will probably be the other committee bill. But these others I put on here because they are they're subject matters that I'd like to scheme with my colleagues to get them before us somehow.
Could you explain the sunset extension for sub-tax credits?
Well, we Senate Bill or House Bill 2067, member put all the tax credits on a sunset schedule, and that schedule starts they start to expire in January of 2012.
Right.
So it's possible that we will start work on that list of tax credits and start our analysis early.
Madam Chair, I might point out that for the agenda for the House Revenue Committee for tomorrow, they're going to talk about some priorities of those credits. Mm-hmm. And they have asked Tim McCabe Business Oregon, Department of Business. Will be there and kind of talking about some of the issues that have come up in their recruiting process and that's kind of where that discussion will be. So that might be worth listening into a few.
Right. One of the things we can expect to see in our committee in February is an effort to take a small part. The Betsy credit is one of the ones that expires in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some major solar manufacturing operations that they've been recruiting. And so I've said that we will want to review a very limited extension of that manufacturing tax credit so that it won't interfere with the recruiting efforts. These manufacturing firms, Solar World is the best example, just bring tremendous benefits in terms of jobs and economic development. So you can expect to see something like that here from either originating here or originating in the House. There may be some other similar areas around the Betsy credit, but overall the Betsy credit will sunset in 2012, which will give us another shot to do what we tried so hard to do last session. Any other comments, Senator House? Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Rosenbaum?
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you, committee. It's great to see you all again. And we are adjourned.
Good luck, session. Good luck, session.